Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show improve. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
So I'm staying out of it. It's going to take a knee like Kaepernick.
You'll be forgiven if you're surprised that I've been paying attention to the start of this year's football season. No doubt Boston fans have it circled on their calendars because the kickoff game is this Thursday night when the Patriots host the Kansas City Chiefs. I'm not a football fan, so I don't really care about that game. No, I've been checking team rosters to see if Colin Kaepernick would get picked up by an NFL team. The former quarterback for the San Francisco 49ers has been unemployed since last year after he began a personal protest, kneeling quietly during the playing of the pregame national anthem. Kaepernick said he wished to bring attention to the spate of police killings of unarmed black men. "To me, this is bigger than football," he said then. "There are bodies in the street and people getting paid leave and getting away with murder." That's what he said last season when he was playing football. Reaction to his stance was swift and angry. Fans burned his uniform. Other players said he was letting his team down. Owners pointed out he was paid to play football, and pundits speculated about his future. Despite his acknowledged talent as a quarterback and his victory leading his team to the Super Bowl, Colin Kaepernick hasn't been playing football. By the way, other players who joined Kaepernick last season in sitting down or kneeling are working. What's more, some owners overlooked rape charges, domestic violence, and drunk driving histories to hire players with checkered criminal pasts. Why are teams bypassing the clean living Kaepernick? Political activists say the reason is simple. He's been blackballed by the league because he took a stand for racial justice. I can't prove it, but I agree. And so does Seattle Seahawks wide receiver Doug Baldwin, who initially thought otherwise. Now Baldwin says, "I definitely think that the league, the owners, are trying to send a message of stay in between the lines." In early August, 1,000 people demonstrated outside NFL headquarters against Kaepernick's apparent blackballing. More than a few fans have urged marquee players to add their voices. Big-ticket Green Bay Packers quarterback Aaron Rodgers did weigh in, telling ESPN the magazine Kaepernick should be on a roster, adding, "I think because of his protests, he's not." If he never suits up again, Colin Kaepernick will join a long line of black athletes who've paid dearly for speaking their conscience. And that includes the beloved Muhammad Ali, who lost 5 of his prime boxing years when he was vocal about segregation and opposition to war. Like Ali, Kaepernick has kept the focus on his cause to stop police killings of unarmed black men. He pledged $1 million to various social justice organizations and has already given away $800,000. And he committed without knowing if he'd ever get another football paycheck. NAACP interim president and CEO Derek Johnson has requested a meeting with the NFL in a letter stating no player should be victimized and discriminated against because of his exercise of free speech. True, but Colin Kaepernick knows better than anybody that his free speech gave him the right to protest, but not the right to a job in the NFL. As you hear this, Kaepernick may have been picked up. Sorry to say, it won't be a brave decision, but likely a desperate move made because of the limited number of available players who are not already injured. This is the NFL, after all. Concussions may be common in football, but from where I sit, character and conscience, not so much. I'm Callie Crossley, WGBH, Boston's local NPR.
Let's take a picture. Last longer.
Let me just take a minute to thank the people who were nice enough to fill in for me while I was away. Noelle King, Stacey Vanek-Smith, and most recently, Dwayne Brown. And while he was here last week, Dwayne Brown went to the National Museum of African American History and Culture. There's a new photography exhibit there which uses everyday images to tell extraordinary stories of history. The exhibit is called More Than a Picture, and it features more than 150 pictures from 80 photographers. The exhibit documents the lives of African Americans going back to the era of Frederick Douglass and Sojourner Truth. There's a picture of a family of 9 enslaved people on a Virginia plantation in the 1860s, and it's rare because the museum was able to identify the names of each and every family member. There's a portrait of Lawrence McVeigh, a member of Harlem's Hellfighters, a World War I regiment of black soldiers. When white soldiers refused to serve in combat with black soldiers, the U.S. military reassigned this group to the French Army, where they fought in French uniforms and earned top honors. There are also several photos of 1960s-era civil rights marches, and alongside these, there are also photographs of more recent protests in Ferguson, Missouri, and Baltimore, Maryland. Curator Aaron Bryant says a lot of the photographs capture small moments that could easily be overlooked.
This photograph that was taken on, I think, the 27th of April, 28th of April, in Baltimore, 2015, and it was during the Freddie Gray protests. And in the image, what we see are these protesters who are linking arms, and behind them are police officers. So from the perspective of how the image was taken and how it's cropped, we get the impression that the protesters have linked arms in solidarity and they've turned their backs to the police. But part of what this exhibition is about is perspective. What you see on the surface of the photograph isn't necessarily what the photograph is actually about. And Jermaine could probably tell us more.
In fact, we have the pleasure of Jermaine. We're going to identify as Jermaine Gibbs?
Yes, Jermaine Gibbs.
All right. And so you took this photo. Give us a sense, because even as a storyteller, as a reporter, two reporters in the same place can tell a different story. Your job is to tell a story through the lens. This picture is told in different ways. What was your perspective?
Actually, I watched this before I actually captured it to see what exactly was going on. And what actually was going on was the crowd was starting to get out of hand because of the police presence getting heavier. So this group of men and a mother and daughter actually linked arms to separate the crowd from the police. So their job actually was protecting the police, and that's what I wanted to show in this, because a lot of people during the riots actually portrayed images of Baltimore being a rough and crazy place and everything was just going haywire. But my goal was to go at a different perspective and actually show the positivity that was going on. So when I seen this, I said, this is something that 20 years from now I could look back and say, yes, this is a powerful image.
And speaking of perspectives, you set us up nicely, because there is one of two photos of a young boy seen around police who are geared up. They've got their riot helmets on, got their shields, and they look a little ominous. Right. However, that picture, in terms of perspective, is not necessarily what you see. Talk about what was really going on here. Describe it for me, would you?
So it was probably about 10 o'clock in the morning, and the police is actually just coming up, setting up, but it was extremely hot. And some adults that came out with cases of water. So the young man went over and asked could he have one of the waters. But they thought he was just going to take it and keep it for himself. But what he did was actually walked over to the officer and handed the officer the water.
What's the message here?
Well, you know, of course, Jermaine has captured this young boy handing a bottle of water to a police officer. And this is in the middle of protests. right? So we get a very different sense about what people who are fighting for justice or communities who are fighting for justice, what that protest looks like. But protests happen in people's lives every single day, just like struggle happens in people's lives every day. So this gesture of giving a bottle of water to the police officer is just a part of this boy's everyday life, in spite of what we might think his life is like.
In this past week, we've heard lots of rhetoric and different perspectives on what we see that went down in Charlottesville. And it makes you wonder, are we looking at the same picture? What can the listener or visitor to the museum take away from looking at pictures from the past as well as the present? Mm-hmm. And what's the takeaway?
Yeah, I think with these photographs in particular, as we look at photographs from, say, 1861 all the way up to 2015 with the two photos we just talked about, there are a couple of things that connect the past with the present and I think the future. What you see is hope and resilience. I think those are really important messages in spite of how life has been confronted with all kinds of struggles or oppositions or barriers. People have continued to progress because they've maintained their hope and their resilience. And I think ultimately that's the message of this exhibition.
That was NPR's Duane Brown speaking with exhibit curator Aaron Bryant and photographer Jermaine Gibbs at the National Museum of African American History and Culture here in Washington, D.C.
Greetings, Gus, and to the rest of the callers. I just wanted to first talk about the white supremacist rallies that were supposed to take place today and tomorrow in the Bay Area. One of them was supposed to take place in San Francisco today and tomorrow in Berkeley, but both of them got canceled for some apparent reason. I'll do more research on that in the meantime. But I could honestly say that I'm satisfied that those rallies got canceled, because if they were to still happen, I would have realized that either one of my friends would have got hurt being there, because I know at least three people wanted to go there. Three of my friends said that they were going to those rallies. I just said okay, because I didn't want to get into a big argument about why they should or shouldn't go, because I wouldn't know myself either.
Yesterday, there was supposed to be a rally of right-wing activists in Berkeley, California, but that mostly fizzled out. Still, thousands of peaceful left-wing demonstrators turned out singing songs and chanting, and about 150 anti-fascists or Antifa or Black Bloc protesters were also there, marching in formation with covered faces. And then a couple of right-wing demonstrators did show up. That's when Al Letson, host of the investigative radio program and podcast Reveal, saw one right-wing guy fall to the ground and some left-wing Antifa protesters start beating him. I talked to Al Letson earlier today, and he said he jumped on top of the guy to protect him.
At some point, when I turned to my left, I saw this gentleman, and either he tripped or somebody tripped him, and he landed on the ground. When he landed on the ground, about five of the people that had been chasing them surrounded them and started kicking him. And I saw somebody take a flagpole and really bring it down really hard on him.
Wow. And
when I glanced to my left, I saw, you know, a mass of people just coming off the lawn towards this guy. And I don't know, I thought they were going to kill him. And I just didn't want anybody to die. And I just put my body down on top of his in the hopes that they would not hit me.
Yeah. I mean, we have to say this, right? Like, some of the people who organized this rally that was supposed to happen that didn't happen are part of the alt-right. This is a philosophy that promotes white nationalism, white rights. And you yourself, you're African-American. Like, what was any of that going through your mind? Or were you just like, this guy doesn't need to be beaten up and it doesn't matter what side you're on?
Yeah, none of it went into my mind at all. What came to me was that he was a human being, and I didn't want to see anybody die. And, you know, I've been thinking a lot about the events in Charlottesville, and I remember seeing the pictures of a young man being brutally beaten by these guys with poles. And when I saw that, I thought, why didn't anybody step in? And, you know, in retrospect, it doesn't matter if he doesn't see my humanity. What matters to me is that I see his. What he thinks about me and all of that, like, my humanity is not dependent upon that.
You're also a reporter. You were there as a journalist. You had your recording equipment with you. You know, and we're always told that reporters aren't supposed to become part of the story. You know, what do you think about that?
I don't want to be a part of the story at all. And I believe in all those journalistic ethics and all of that. But I also think that before that, I'm a human being. You know, I mean, this sounds really high-minded and maybe a little nutty, but I am a huge NPR nerd. And many years ago, I was listening to Terry Gross, and Father Greg Boyle was on there. And he gave this quote that has just stuck with me ever since. He said, I want to live like the truth is true and go where love has not been found. And it's how I want to govern myself in the world. So when I get into this situation where the decision is, do you be a journalist or do you be a human? I'm going to put the journalism to the side and do the thing that feels right for me.
How has this, if it has, changed how you think about these leftist protesters, these Antifa protesters? I mean, these were the people inflicting violence on this person.
Yeah, it hasn't really changed the way I think about them at all. I think that the problem that happens when we have the Antifa or people on the left engaging in violence is that it shifts the narrative, right? Like, suddenly we are equating people that are fighting Nazis with Nazis, and the two things don't equate, right? And we've seen what they can do when they're in power. So we see and know exactly what that is. It's a false equivalency to say that the people fighting back against that are the exact same. But I also see how the violence that is coming from the Antifa movement can be spun to make it seem like the two are equivalent. So, you know, we're living in tricky times when there's a lot of nuance that needs to be walked through. And America is not good at nuance. So I think for me, it didn't change the way I thought about them. But it does mean that as a reporter and as a producer, as a journalist, that I'm thinking even more about what that nuance means and how to communicate it to the audience.
Al Letson hosts Reveal. It's a podcast and a radio show from the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Seattle's a great place to visit because it has, I guess you could say, a little bit of everything, but I like to think of it as a lot of everything.
Seattle's Central District was once the largest black enclave in the Pacific Northwest. That's not the case anymore. An architect and Central District resident, Donald King, says that trend will continue.
Our old sense of a black community will be gone in the next 20 years.
So in the face of rapid displacement, how can the Central District hold on to a sense of black history and community? On a recent Saturday, two walking tours covered the same few blocks of the Central District and approached the question in two different ways. Region of Boom producer Posey Gruner has more.
The first tour was put on by The Urbanist, an organization focused on urban policy. A group of about 30 met near the corner of 23rd and Jackson.
I'm just curious, is anybody here from the central area? Are you all from scattered parts around the town?
The tour discussed ways that buildings can reflect and support their community. That could be as simple as a plaque on the wall or as complicated as an ownership structure. The second tour was put on by Tabernacle Missionary Baptist Church, which has been in the Central District for more than 60 years. Tour members walked the neighborhood in neon green vests, saying hello and inviting people to a barbecue. One tour member, Daniel Ellis, stopped to chat.
Well, basically, we're just walking and in the community in which we live and noticing the change that, you know, a lot of people are moving in and a lot of people are being probably forced out.
For a brief moment, around 11 a.m., the two tours collided. Architect Donald King was talking about the building that will go up where the Red Apple Market is now. Vulcan, Paul Allen's real estate company, met repeatedly with the community as the project was being designed.
It set a standard for the community and feeling empowered that they could make a difference in what they saw going up around them. And sort of understanding that you can't stop this development, but how can you shape it in a way that is more community friendly?
Yolanda McGee, a drop-in from the church tour, listened for a moment, then walked away.
I didn't know if there was for or against what's happening here. Basically, this is all displacement, the way I see it.
As for community building, McGee says she prefers doing that face-to-face. She mentions the church barbecue and that anyone is welcome.
Just come and see us, you know, so we can shake hands and meet a friend. That's the way I see it. But is that really going to happen? I don't see it happening. So this is all talk to me. What they're doing is all just talk.
King, the architect, disagrees.
As an architect, I have a different view of the world. And I believe that there is a place where the physical structure itself and the planning and urban design of the neighborhood can facilitate community.
He points out that the barbecue is happening at a church, which is a building.
So we're not able to do everything, but the part that planners and architects can do is to be able to encourage that and facilitate the gathering space that they're doing that socialization.
The urbanist tour wraps up around 1 p.m. Meanwhile, at 28th and Jackson, the Tabernacle barbecue is in full swing.
Okay. Nothing much. What's going on with you?
Same old soup on dough.
Daniel Ellis is at the Domino's table.
Thank you.
That's the game.
Thank you.
You got 50.
But he doesn't last long.
Well, the two players with the lowest score have to get up for others to come in and play. And so I was one of those who were gracious enough to give the next person a chance.
Daniel says he did notice one big change when he was out walking. The church where he found God has become an apartment building. It makes him sad to think that history is gone.
Yeah, a lot of people just take advantage of what has already been built with no regard or respect for what it took to establish what they're trying to take advantage of. And I think that we miss out a lot when we do that, because if we don't know what our history was, how will we be able to build on it?
As for how to know that history and how to build on it, both tours agree that getting out in the neighborhood and meeting your neighbors is a pretty good way to start. In Seattle Central District, I'm Posey Gruner, KUOW News.
Anti-black attitudes.
Double whammy.
The fight over who's a real American and who's entitled to live here can be a little galling to Native Americans. But even Native Americans can have their own disputes over who belongs. One such dispute involves the Cherokee Nation of Oklahoma. The Cherokee once held people of African descent as slaves. They became free after the Civil War. Culturally, those freed slaves were more Cherokee than anything else. But in 2007, the Constitution of the Cherokee Nation was amended to exclude these freedmen, as they're known. Then yesterday, a U.S. court ruled that was illegal. Marilyn Vann was lead plaintiff in the case and is on the line now from Oklahoma City. Marilyn, congratulations on winning the case. You must be pleased.
Well, thank you very much. It's been a long, hard battle for us to get to this point.
Marilyn, am I right in thinking that you had a grandparent who was a freedman himself?
Well, actually, it was my father, who was about 60 years old when I was born. He was listed as a freedman on the Dawes Roll.
Now, the Dawes Roll is relevant to this, but give us just a thumbnail explanation of what was achieved in court.
What was achieved in court was that the people of African descent, known as freedmen, the court reinforced our right to remain Cherokee tribal members and indicated that we could not simply be removed at the whim and the will of this chief or that chief or this council. So it's a great victory for people who believe in tribal rights, civil rights, and in human rights.
Who is affected by this ruling? I mean, after 150 years, so many families must be mixed with families of other backgrounds. What's the criteria?
Well, a freedman was a person whose ancestor was listed as, quote-unquote, as a freedman on the Dawes Rolls, which were made about 1900 in order to divide the tribal lands.
Why is it important for you to be part of the Cherokee Nation?
Because, okay, first of all, my ancestors, they were a part of the tribe. They came on the Trail of Tears. The freedmen people, our ancestors, helped save the tribe, helped build the tribe. Most of the freedmen do have documented Indian ancestry. And this is who we are. It's like as if, you know, various tribal leaders, they have tried to rewrite our history, rewrite the history of the tribe to be something other than it is. This is who we are.
Now, not to sound cynical, but is there any financial benefit or practical benefit to being a citizen of the Cherokee Nation at this point?
There are some benefits. Every member of the tribe has access to go to various tribal or Indian health service clinics, regardless of their income. There are various different programs dealing with rental assistance or the like for low-income people, but also for a lot of things you need to live in the 14-county service area for the tribe. So, yes, there might be some benefits just depending on your situation and your location.
You had to fight hard for this recognition or re-recognition. It took about 10 years. How do you feel about the community of freedmen being rejected by the officials of the Cherokee Nation for so long?
You know, it's very saddening to have people, you know, play the race card. It's the old Hitler playbook, you know, point at somebody that looks different or worships different and try to make them the enemy so that you can gain power or keep power. It is sad to think that your neighbors, your own relatives reject you, pretend that, and some people may really be ignorant, but pretend that they don't know who you are or what you, or anything. Unfortunately, there are a lot of people in the tribe that know very little about the tribe. A lot of the people in the tribe, they look Caucasian, they live lives of white privilege, and know nothing about the tribe except that they have a card.
Now, what are you going to do to try to help heal the wounds among the members of the tribe?
Well, one thing is that myself and other people that are freedmen Cherokees, I think we are going to try to build up our own communities. Let's all come together and build this tribe and go forward.
Marilyn Vann was the lead plaintiff in a legal case that fought and just won full citizenship of the Cherokee Nation of Oklahoma for the freedmen, the descendants of Cherokee slaves. Marilyn, can you say goodbye to us in Cherokee?
The word is, it actually comes, is until we meet again, donda doggle dahi.
Thanks so much, Marilyn.
Thank you. Wado.
As your body grows bigger, your mind must flower. It's great to learn,
because knowledge is power.
It's Schoolhouse Rocking, the chip off the block.
Today is the first day of the new school year at Portland Public Schools. Students are heading back to class in the wake of a damning series of articles in the Oregonian. They focused on the way the district handled numerous allegations of sexual misconduct that were brought against one teacher. Mitch Whitehurst worked at seven different PPS schools in a career that spanned more than three decades. He did so despite being the subject of many credible and serious allegations. The latest reporting suggests that the way Whitehurst's case was handled could be a part of a pattern. Bethany Barnes is a reporter behind these stories, and she joins me now. Thanks very much for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
There's a pretty complicated timeline in your reporting because, as I mentioned, this really does span decades. There were some allegations of inappropriate behavior that span a lot of that time. But when was there the first official written complaint against him?
Yeah. So what we know is from the documents, there was this woman named Rose Soto, who I found and interviewed for my reporting. And she reports in 2001. And at least according to the documents, that's the first time the district is sort of on knowledge or on notice about this.
What did she report?
So she was a student aide. It was one of her electives. And she reported that for about nearly a year, he was trying to date her. He would come on to her. He would say, let's go to a hotel room where no one can see us. Let's have dinner. And this went on for quite some time. He'd made comments about her appearance, and then
this is when she was a high school student.
Yes, when she was a high school senior. And so she finally does a report because the last straw, she said, was that he made a comment about her pants. And she had pants that had a zipper in the back. And she said that he said, you know why they're so great? It's because of the zipper. You could just unzip them and boom, we're on it. And this, she said, made her very frightened. And she did this written complaint that she turned into the office.
What happened when she did that?
So what she says happened is that she did an interview with police, and that's documented in a police report where she relays all of this in front of the vice principal. And then the human resources lawyer at the district interviewed Mitch Whitehurst. And Mitch Whitehurst, according to the notes from that interview, said, well, I may have asked her for hotel recommendations for prom. I told her to think about the message she was sending. And then after they interview him, they put him back on staff.
What did they do in terms of the of what she had said? I mean, did they talk to her to get her side of the story? I mean, they were present during the interview by police, and as you write in the story, that the police found that they could not bring charges against him. But did they talk to her?
According to the documents, they did not. So the investigation would have been run by their human resources lawyer, and she only has interview notes, and she tended to write everything down from talking to Whitehurst. It does not look that she, the decider, talked to Rose Soto. Rose said she never spoke with her. And, you know, I talked to an educator sexual misconduct person who said, like, this is what you would expect a predator to say. It's not very credible to ask a 17-year-old for hotel recommendations.
Based on what you have since learned, what had some of Whitehurst's other students already experienced? Because what you're talking about happened in 2001, but he'd been there from the mid-80s in various PPS schools.
Right. And so basically what we also know from the documents is you fast forward to 2008, and this woman comes forward and reports that when she was at Franklin High in the 1980s, he had come on to her. She and a friend had gone to his apartment complex where he demanded oral sex from both of them. She fled and the friend stayed. And so she reports that in 2008 to the same human resources lawyer that dismissed the other complaint. And at that time, the PPS lawyer decides to do nothing. She actually writes in a memo, "I will take no further action."
Is there any explanation as to why? I mean, because those same allegations were brought up again, I think, 4 years later in 2012. By this point, it was clear based on your reporting that there had been a pattern of reports. Have you been able to learn anything from current PPS employees or the people who made these decisions before as to why they didn't take more action?
That is somewhat unclear. I mean, the lawyer that made that decision, Maureen Sloan, has not talked to me about it. She hung up on our opinion writer who tried to talk to her about it, because she does talk to this woman and she doesn't even try and reach out to the friend who also went to this apartment, who the state, when they investigated, there's the teacher licensing agency, and they eventually get a hold of all this. They reach out to her and she tells this horrifying story of being trapped in the apartment and feeling like she couldn't leave without doing something. And I mean, she doesn't attempt to do any of that to flesh this out. She doesn't at that point even refer this to the teacher licensing agency at all. And it's very unclear why that was taken, there no action was taken.
Whitehurst moved around all over the district over the course of his 30-plus year career, five different high schools plus a middle school and a K-8 school. When he would move to a new school, were administrators at the new school made aware of these previous allegations?
No, not usually. So how it works with the teacher union contract is any unsubstantiated allegations of any kind or concerns can't go in your personnel file. You have what's called a building file, which is just something your boss keeps on you. And according to the agreement, anything in the building file has to be taken out when you are get a new boss or when you change schools.
If you're just tuning in, I'm talking right now with Bethany Barnes, a reporter for the Oregonian, Oregon Live. She's written a series of articles about how Portland Public Schools, in a number of cases, failed to respond to allegations of sexual misconduct against a teacher who worked for the district for more than 30 years. There are a lot of head-shaking moments in what you reported, but one of them happened just 4 years ago when Whitehurst was teaching at Fabian K-8. Can you tell us what happened?
Right. So Whitehurst ends up at this K-8 school. He goes from being athletic director at Jefferson High, one of the highest paid PPS employees, and then he's suddenly at this school where he's a gym teacher. And what happens is the eighth grade girls in his gym class start boycotting his class because they think he's creepy. They're afraid of him. And according to interviews, when they eventually launch an investigation into this, you have about 14 girls saying, "We see him stare at our butts and chests. He's staring at me. I feel that I need to hide, but it's a grade." And they start this massive campaign of wearing shoes that aren't appropriate for PE so they can sit out because they're afraid he's going to stare at them.
How did officials either in the school or in the district respond to this? Here, this is not just one young woman. We're talking about a number of them, you know, reporting all the same thing. What did the district do?
Right. So from what we can know on the documents is they start an investigation in which they interview all of the girls in this class, I think about 17 of whom say they're uncomfortable. And the investigation ends up going nowhere, and there's no paperwork about why this happened. A PPS lawyer, Stephanie Harper, gave a deposition sort of related to this, saying that the conclusion was that this was rumors, and which is sort of interesting because if you read the interviews with these girls, they're not rumors. They're how they feel, what they're experiencing, and things they are witnessing. There's one or two girls or three or four that are like, "Well, I don't know. Maybe it's rumors." But there are several girls who are saying, "I'm made to feel uncomfortable. I see him do X, Y, Z."
But nevertheless, he was not removed or disciplined at that point. What did finally lead to his termination?
Right. And so what happened is that a coworker of his at Fabian ends up complaining about him because in this sort of odd incident, this coworker is talking to a teacher and he said Whitehurst came up behind him and poked him in the anus. and he was horrified by this. He had had a prior incident with Whitehurst where he told him to not slap him on the butt, and yet this happened anyway. And a few weeks prior, a different coworker had been slapped on the butt by Whitehurst in front of almost everyone at the school at the staff breakfast, and the principal had told him to never touch the coworkers in that way again, and yet this happened, and he called the police. And then there's a police investigation into this poking that sort of unearths this other stuff.
After so many young women had come forward and talked about inappropriate behavior, what does it tell you that it was only after a man and an adult complained that action was finally taken?
You know, that's something a lot of people have dug into on this story. It was one thing when I talked to the educator sexual misconduct expert, who's the sort of leader and people who study this, I laid out the timeline and she was like, are you kidding me? What? This is what happened. It's something the woman who reported what happened to her in the 80s, she twice reported and she was, why is this happening? And people sort of tend to read that as a power thing, that he was someone that people would finally pay attention to. I can't really know why he finally got their attention.
We got this email from the district about the Whitehurst case from the spokesman, Harry Estev. As we have acknowledged, these issues should have been addressed at the time, and we are sorry they weren't. At the direction of the school board, Portland Public Schools is hiring an independent outside investigator to undertake a thorough review of this case and to make recommendations on what we need to change within our system to prevent this from happening again. We're also in the process of hiring a Title IX coordinator to handle allegations of sexual harassment and abuse, and we are revising our complaint process to be more responsive. No student should ever be subjected to abuse or harassment from any PPS staff. We will take any allegation of this kind of behavior extremely seriously. Is this case unique from what you've been able to find so far? Obviously, your initial reporting focused on the many allegations against this one teacher. Is there a pattern here?
There could be. I mean, that's something that remains unknown. You do have – I think there are some unique factors at play here where you do have people coming forward. And because when I talked to the educator sexual misconduct expert, she was like, wow, so often people don't come forward. It's rare to get these sort of complaints, which you can really seize on. She actually said rumors should be taken seriously, not just believed out of hand, but just you should pay attention to them. But I did a story recently on a former paralegal who was assigned to read all of the legal files when she got there. And she said she noticed the Whitehurst case, went to her boss, Stephanie Harper, said, what is this? This is very troubling. And when she told me about all that, I said, well, are there other files we should be worried about since you read all of them? And she said, yes, there are. And I said, other instances where students' opinions were discounted or that you think should have warranted more investigation? She said, yes, I'd be happy to point the district to them.
And that's what you're working on now.
Yeah.
Bethany, thanks very much for coming in.
Thanks so much.
That's Bethany Barnes. She covers education for The Oregonian. You'll find links to her articles on our website, opb.org/thinkoutloud.
You'll never forget me. You want to know why? Because I'm a liar. Yeah, I'm a liar. I'll rip your mind out. I'll burn your soul.
Reported last week, I believe it was, that Joshua Witt, who you can see here in this photo, who made a complaint that he was stabbed because someone in the place where he was, his story was that they went up to him and told him he was looked like a Nazi, and so they stabbed him. You may have seen the graphic photo that he uploaded of himself. So there he is, Joshua Witt. Next is the graphic photo that he showed. Lols, apparently I look like a neo-Nazi, so I get stabbed at. According to a report, Witt had originally said that on August 16, he was exiting his car outside a Steak and Shake restaurant when someone approached him and asked if he was a neo-Nazi and went to stab him. He claimed he was slashed on the hand when shielding himself, and the suspect ran away. Now, the police found some problems with his stories. They found someone that fit the description of his, quote, assailant, but they had doubts that that was actually someone who participated in any incident. They also couldn't find video of the incident he mentioned. However, according to the report, police turned up video from a nearby sporting goods store, which depicted Witt buying a knife. Officials said investigators asked him about this on Thursday, and he admitted that he cut himself by mistake while in his parked car in front of the store, the statement said. So there you go. There's your update.
I don't understand how he cut himself in a parked car. Like, he wasn't chopping onions or something.
No. So, first of all, let me just say that I reported on this story when I probably should not have. So, my bad there, guys, and I want to let you know. And the reason I say that is I was reporting what others were reporting, and I believe, let me leave out the name of the publication that we mainly relied on there. But that's what the police reports were, so it's not their fault, it's not necessarily my fault. Except for the fact that in the production meeting, we did have a discussion about this story, and some of the other folks in the meeting said, this doesn't look right, right? Let's hold off on this. But one of the reasons I did it is because if it was really a leftist who was attacking a guy because he thought he looked like a Nazi, I don't want to downplay leftist violence. And there's some today from Antifa at Berkeley. Mm-hmm. And it drives me crazy, and it is just as morally repugnant. Yes, the other side, it has fascists and Nazis. That doesn't mean we should sink to their level. It means we should fight back with every ounce of our energy politically and morally in every way, shape, and possible. And I'm not one to go soft. But violence is a terrible idea. It's a moral idea. It's counterproductive. That's why I can't cover that story when it appeared that it was someone who was attacking someone who's right wing. But the rest of the team was right that there was something fishy about that story. And every once in a while, and in this case, it wasn't covered by right-wing sites. It was covered by mainstream news sites, okay? But every once in a while, the right wing will get a story, and they'll go nuts over it. Oh, look, I'm the press isn't covering this, and this is amazing, and this is outrageous. And then you'll find out, no, it was not at all. And so in this case, I think it's just one particular dude who was looking for attention. We don't know with 100% certainty. We know the facts that Brett just gave you. But like Anna said, it doesn't look like he was chopping onions in his car. He went and bought a knife right beforehand, that we do know. Mm-hmm. It seems like he cut himself to get attention.
Well, there's multiple ways to interpret the events. One is that he went and was like, oh, before I get my steak and shake, let's make up a crazy story and play it out. So he goes and he gets it, cuts his hand, does the photo, and it's a nefarious thing. The other one is he accidentally cut himself, and then afterwards he posts this funny, this thing he thought was funny, like now I'm a Nazi, but then he runs with it. Either way, I think the takeaway is violence isn't good. Mm-hmm. And whether this was the right story to report on or not, or it was reported too early or too late, I think the concern that violence undercuts any claims towards some kind of moral authority is worth bringing up.
Right.
It's unfortunate that the facts of the case change from one day to another, but I think the priority being making sure that violence isn't something that we do because you lose authority after it is a good point to make.
Absolutely, I agree.
Is that a real gun?
Yes, this is a real gun.
Do you kill people?
No, if some guy's hurting someone, I try to shoot him in the leg or something just to stop him.
Mama says policemen shoot black people.
Is it true? Yeah, is it true?
Is that true?
Yeah, is it true?
Is that true?
Is it true?
A 27-year police veteran has been fired from Cobb County, Georgia, after he was caught on dash cam surveillance saying something that should shock and upset most Americans. Now, I don't want to give too much away, but before we go to the video showing what he said, let me give you some context.
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 Context. Context.
Looking at behavior in context.
He apparently pulled over a female driver for a routine traffic stop. There was some sort of traffic violation, and apparently the woman was afraid to move her hands or put her hands down because she was fearful that any sudden movement would result in her getting shot. Now, his reaction to her refusing to do as he said is what eventually got him fired. Take a look.
I can't call them if you don't open the door.
Why can't you?
Because I will not put my...
Use your phone. It's in your lap right there.
I just don't want to put my hands down. I'm really sorry. I'm just...
You're just really wrong.
No. I've just been way too many videos of problems.
But you're not black. Remember, we only kill black people. Yeah, we only kill black people, right? All the videos you've seen, have you seen black people get killed? You have.
So the cop in the video is, or was, Police Lieutenant Greg Abbott. That's his name, which is kind of amazing. And he has been fired, and that's according to the police chief in Cobb County, who gave a press conference today. And he did have some strong words for him as well. Now, first, let's go to the police officer's lawyer, who claims, quote, he was attempting to de-escalate a situation involving an uncooperative passenger. In context, his comments were clearly aimed at attempting to gain compliance by using the passenger's own statements and reasoning to avoid making an arrest. However, Mike Register, who is the police chief in Cobb County, disagrees. He said no matter what context it was said, it shouldn't have been said. And again, Abbott, a 27-year veteran of the police department, will be removed from the force. And that's according to Mike Register, who is the police chief in the area.
Well, if you believe in respecting the police, I'm positive you're going to respect the decision of the police chief that this man should be fired. So, first of all, I don't know what's in Abbott's head. I don't know if he was saying that just straightforward. Yeah, that's what we do. We shoot black people. Why would we shoot you? Or if he meant it as, like, you saw the videos online, or you saw the videos, those are the ones that are claiming we only shoot black people. So what are you worried about? You only saw people, black people getting shot, right? Mm-hmm. So he might have meant it that way. That's why the police chief doing what he did is a huge indicator. Because now it might be that he was like, this is not, one, if you're being the most generous to Abbott, you might say the police chief was like, this is bad PR, I don't want to deal with it. Mm-hmm. Okay. Another possibility is, look, even if the guy didn't mean it that way, we can't have people in this county thinking that we are going to apply justice differently to different races and have this idea out there that there are cops who think, no, don't worry, if you're white, you're fine, but black people, we will shoot. And the third possibility is that he talked to Abbott and he was like, oh, this is a bad dude. And he did mean it, and I got to get rid of him.
Right.
So he didn't give exact reasons other than what Anna just read you, but the fact that he did take that action is clearly indicative.
Right. I mean, look, none of us can say for certain what's in that police lieutenant's head as he's making those statements. Some have argued that he was just being sarcastic, but those are not the type of statements you make considering the type of climate that we're living in right now, considering the type of debates that are going on in the country regarding police violence and excessive force. And so it was a bad move on his part. But I think there's another component to that video that should concern you, and I think it's telling to say the least. So the woman who was pulled over for that traffic stop was a white woman, and she was fearful of the cop. She was did not trust the cop. She was worried that he wasn't there to protect her or to protect and serve. And so think about that type of climate that exists in the United States, where the people that we hire as police officers, that we pay with our taxpayer money, are individuals that are no longer trusted because of what we're seeing in the media, because of what we're seeing with all of these police shootings where unarmed people get gunned down. So I would be afraid as well, right?
Yeah.
And so that's something that everyone should take into consideration. If we want the feelings toward cops to change, then obviously the training needs to change, the type of rhetoric we hear from cops needs to change. There needs to be an entire reform for things to change.
Yeah. Look, it's possible that she had been doing something wrong, speeding, drinking, driving. We don't know that context. But the context overall for the country is one that Anna just described. And it's not, look, it is disproportionately African Americans, as the stats bear out. But do white people get shot by cops for having a slight wrong reaction in a nanosecond? Well, of course we know that happens. In Minnesota, that mom got shot when she called for help from the cops, a white woman there. You had the white guy in Miami, the white guy that came out of a car after he was on a high speed chase. I mean, of course, white unarmed people also get shot. And it's for the 100th time in a row, it's the training where we've told the cops, if you're even 1% afraid of anything, if they move their hands up or down, put them down. Mm-hmm. So now we're all jittery. Anytime you get pulled over by a cop and he gives you directions on what to do with your hands, there is some reasonable fear of what might happen next. And the way to allay that fear is not to tell her, don't worry, we only shoot black people. At a minimum, that is incredibly poor judgment.
Storms over Texas. Hurricane Harvey has struck the Gulf region of Texas, and it has hit with an awe and power that can scarcely be believed. Houston, which took the title to the fourth largest city in America from Philadelphia years ago, now has a new title, most flooded U.S. city in U.S. history. Harvey became a tropical storm, spun back into the Gulf, and returned with a vengeance, spilling over 50 inches of rain in hours, sending most of the city into floods that Americans haven't seen since Katrina in New Orleans. It arrives just in time to remind people what global warming means, even as its idiotic misleader claims climate change is a hoax. President Trump, called by some insane clown president, once called climate change just that, as he arrives for a photo op. Is it a hoax now? Thousands of people are watching their lives wash away with higher and higher floodwaters. Politicians, whores of their corporate funders, are smiling as they bank their donations, while mothers and grandmothers and children drown in their attics and in flood-swollen streets in America's fourth largest city. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Joining us now is Harris County Judge Ed Emmett. He's the top elected official for the county that includes Houston, and he directs emergency management services there. Judge Emmett, thank you for making the time today.
Good afternoon.
I'd like to begin with the decision you made not to evacuate Harris County and therefore the city of Houston. At a news conference on Friday, you said evacuations for water are usually related to storm surge rather than rain. Let's hear just a bit of that press conference.
At this time, I can reemphasize, there will be no mass evacuations called. We'll have a lot of water, but it's not the kind of water that we would ask people to evacuate from.
Judge Emmett, was that the right decision?
Yes, it was. Looking at it now, you say, my goodness, those of us who remember the evacuation in front of Hurricane Rita, it was an absolute nightmare. It was chaos, and many, many people died on the roads. The other situation, the difference is when a storm surge comes, you know where it's going to hit.
Mm-hmm.
You know which neighborhoods you need to evacuate. If it's an 8-foot storm surge, we have zones. We can say how high it's going to come up on land, and we evacuate those people. In a rain event like this, a very significant rain event, matter of fact, this is a 1,000-year rain event by everybody's measure, you don't know which neighborhoods are going to be affected, so you would, in essence, have to evacuate the entire region, not just Harris County, Galveston County, Brazoria County, Fort Bend County. You're talking about almost 7 million people. That's just not, and where would those 7 million go? There aren't shelters set up for them. It would not have been something that people would have taken kindly to, shall we say.
Right now we're hearing of people.
And it wouldn't have been the right thing.
Right now we're hearing of people waiting hours on hold with 911. Do you have a sense of how big the backlog is of demand for urgent emergency response?
I don't at this time. I know it was bad. We have, in Harris County and City of Houston, we have three large 911 call centers. But again, this is an event that's absolutely unprecedented. And we are pulling people out as fast as possible, first responders. It was complicated even more. The state sent resources, National Guard and Texas Task Force 1, but they couldn't get through the high water either to get here. So that's when I put out the call for private residents, if they had boats, to come help and coordinate it through us.
And more rain is coming, which means more people will need rescuing. So is help on the way, or should people expect to fend for themselves?
No. That's not necessarily true. More rain is coming. The areas that have flooded are flooded. And now National Guard is here. Texas Task Force 1 is here. And we are working as fast as we can to remove all those people out of harm's way.
So if people are concerned about rising water where they are, is help on the way, or are they more or less going to have to fend for themselves or hope that a neighbor stops by?
Well, as I just said, help is already here. The National Guard is now here. Texas Task Force One is now here. Many, many private folks are also here assisting the first responders. We are pulling people out. Houston Police Department, Sheriff's Office, Constables, National Guard, everybody is full at it, and we're getting that number down as rapidly as we can.
Our reporters are describing shelters that do not have enough food, that are already overcrowded. If more people show up to those shelters, will there be enough cots for them? Will there be food for them?
There will be, but the same circumstance applies. The Houston Food Bank was surrounded by water, and so therefore trucks couldn't get in and out in order to deliver food to the Red Cross shelters. That is being done now that the National Guard is here. We have put together a plan. The first responders were pulling people out and bringing them to high ground, to safe places as fast as they could. And now we have put together a logistical plan with Metro to use their buses to go pick up people and take them to the shelter, but not just any shelter. One of the lessons we've learned from hurricanes over the years is you really don't want people to be too far from their homes, even if their homes aren't livable. The children will still need to be back in school, not this year, not this week, but perhaps next week. People need to be close to their jobs, and we want to make this we want to restore their life to as normal as possible as soon as possible.
The phrase that was used at the press conference this afternoon was, we're going to have to get used to a new normal. Just briefly in the final seconds, what do you see that new normal as being?
I think there will be people out of homes for years, depending on how quickly FEMA can work, and FEMA is already in Texas. But again, this is an unprecedented event that we have never seen. And we have to remind people, Houston, Harris County did not get hit by the hurricane. There are still other parts of the
tropical
state
storm. Harris County, Judge Ed Emmett, we appreciate your time. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Harvey has strained the healthcare system in Houston as well. Aside from attending to the injured, there are also life-saving treatments needed by patients with chronic diseases. One of those is dialysis. Tamika Weatherspoon from Houston Public Media visited the DaVita Medical Center dialysis facility and filled me in a little while ago. Tamika, thank you for being with us. First off, just give us an idea of how many people we're talking about here.
Well, when we arrived, there were upwards of at least 100 people in the clinic. When I was talking to some of the volunteers and the staff there, they were saying they'd seen hundreds who had come in during the storm. They were only closed for one day, and that's just because Sunday was, you know, horrific for anybody trying to travel. But other than that, they'd been open, and they'd been seeing patients and getting quite a bit of overflow.
Try to give us an idea of how serious this problem is, Tamika. If someone misses a dialysis appointment, that's a big deal, isn't it?
It's a huge deal. Honestly, if you miss an appointment, these treatments are regular and scheduled for a reason. It's deadly. It's potentially deadly. It's potentially fatal if you don't receive these treatments. Dialysis itself is to clean out the blood. So certain types of liver and kidney diseases, they're unable to do that. So it's really critical that they're able to get these treatments. I talked to a doctor, Dr. Oliveira, at the clinic, and he was just telling me how his staff was working nonstop, pretty much, to administer these treatments to all of these people.
What is an inconvenience for many people having this type of storms, it can be a matter of life and death to these dialysis patients.
Tamika, I know you've had a chance to talk to some patients. How are they coping?
Well, it was really difficult, actually, to be in the clinic. You know, there were a lot of people waiting for this life-saving treatment. And just the distance that people had to come to get there, it's really tough to kind of witness that. But the patients I was able to speak with were really optimistic and really grateful to have a clinic that was actually open when their local clinics had been closed due to all of the flooding and, you know, just difficulty with traveling. I talked to a patient while she was receiving treatment. Her name was Deborah Payne, and she was just really happy to still be alive.
I was afraid. I just, you know, I didn't know what I was going to do. And I'm sure all the other people who couldn't make it, who know that they have to do this to survive, were concerned about whether they were going to make it here or not.
This has to be a huge strain on the hospital staffs. Give us a sense of how they're coping.
Well, they're being really optimistic, much like some of the people, the patients that I spoke with. They were really passionate and really, really cared about helping everyone that was there. But they were still working incredibly long hours. And honestly, you know, you could see them a little bit tired. You could kind of see it in their eyes. But they really cared about what they were doing. They were understaffed and, you know, had not as much resources as they probably need. But they were just, you know, really, really passionate about helping everyone that was there.
Tamika Weatherspoon with Houston Public Media. Thank you.
Thank you.
A reminder that if you're looking to give to Harvey relief efforts, you can donate to a number of groups working on the ground. Organizations, including the Red Cross, are accepting donations online or by phone.
There's been a lot of focus this week on the immediate damage created by Hurricane Harvey in Texas. But as we've been hearing today on the show, the focus is now slowly shifting to Houston's recovery. And here's one very alarming figure that's likely to factor into that recovery. Only an estimated 2 out of every 10 homeowners in Houston have flood insurance. Carolyn Kuski is Director of Policy Research and Engagement at the Wharton Risk Center at the University of Pennsylvania. Carolyn, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me on today.
Thanks for being here. That figure of 2 in 10 Houston homeowners who have flood insurance, it's surprisingly low. Or is it? Why do so few people have it?
It is low, and it's surprisingly low in Houston given the flood risk, but it's low nationwide. Very few people end up having flood coverage. There's a number of reasons for that. Sometimes people don't realize that their standard homeowner's policy excludes floods, and in order to be covered against flood damages, you have to have a separate policy from the National Flood Insurance Program.
So the only flood insurance that's available to most homeowners if they want it is through this federal program? How does it work?
That's right. There's a very small private market, but for the most part, you have to get it through the NFIP. The program was set up back in 1968, largely in response to the fact that there was little availability of flood coverage from the private sector. It was designed as a partnership between the federal government and communities. So communities voluntarily join the program. When they do that, they have to adopt some minimum floodplain management regulations. And then in exchange, all their residents are eligible to purchase flood insurance through the program.
So if you live in the federally drawn flood zone, right, then you have to have the insurance. The insurance is subsidized through the federal government. That's sort of the idea here. What does the flood zone look like? How do they draw it?
Yeah, FEMA produces flood maps that show flood hazard for communities. And the most important feature of those maps is the 100-year floodplain, which is sometimes referred to as the special flood hazard area. And if you are mapped inside that area and you have a mortgage from a federally backed or regulated lender, you are required to have flood insurance. And yet we still see, so for example, estimates from FEMA are that in Harris County, only about 30% of households in that special flood hazard area have flood insurance despite this requirement. And it could be because they don't have a qualifying mortgage, and so they're actually not required to, or it could be because they've dropped their policy and they're out of compliance with this regulation.
So you can build in the flood zone with sort of the official government warning behind it that, like, hey, you live in a flood-prone area, but you don't have to have the insurance that the government provides in this case, and that just leaves you exposed.
Yeah, and outside of the special flood hazard area, we see very low take-up of flood insurance. And as we're seeing in Houston right now, flooding is not restricted to this mapped area. It occurs beyond it repeatedly because you have events that are larger than a 100-year event, or also because the maps often fail to show areas of stormwater flooding. So when you have a very intense downpour and it overwhelms local drainage, that type of flooding is not usually depicted on maps. And so there's lots of people who might be at flood risk and have had no idea they were at flood risk.
And so, Carolyn, even inside the federally mandated flood zone where the subsidized federal flood insurance works, we've even seen figures drop, as you mentioned, in recent years. In Houston, the number of homes with the flood insurance is down 9% from 5 years ago. In nearby areas, I saw a figure that said it's down 20%. People are dropping coverage.
People are, and this is true if you look nationwide. The number of policies in force has been declining over recent years, and there's a little bit of puzzlement over what that is. One factor that's probably playing a role here is price. So in 2012 and 2014, Congress passed some reform legislation to phase out some discounts that had been given to roughly 20% of policyholders. And these discounted rates that were given to people who had built before FEMA came in and mapped the area, as they're being phased out, those property owners are facing higher and higher rates, and that might be responsible for some people choosing to drop their flood insurance because it's just getting too expensive for them. But all the underlying factors are a little bit unknown.
So let's talk about then the economic impact here, Carolyn, with all of the exposure that you're talking about, right? With such a low percentage of homes in the flood zone and outside of the flood zone that are covered, that means thousands, hundreds of thousands of homeowners completely exposed to the cost of recovery without insurance. How does the risk adjuster or the economist or the recovery expert look at the overwhelming cost of that and how people pay to get their lives back on track?
Yeah, it's going to be a real struggle for a lot of homeowners in Houston and other areas that have been flooded. Insurance is really essential for resilience of households and communities after a disaster in order to have money quickly to rebuild. And lots of studies have shown that you're much more likely to rebuild and rebuild faster if you have insurance. And part of that is because federal disaster aid is actually quite limited and often delayed. It takes a lot longer to get to people sometimes than insurance does. So President Trump authorized a disaster declaration for Texas, and this allows FEMA to begin spending on what's called the individual assistance program. So they'll provide grants to flood victims, but they're capped at a little over $30,000. Historically, the average is only about $5,000. And so they're really only to make your home safe and habitable. They are not to bring you back to pre-disaster condition. So in order to have the funding to bring yourself, to repair your home to what it looked like before it was flooded, you really have to have insurance. The other line of help for victims would be a loan from the Small Business Administration. And even though it's the Small Business Administration, they do give loans to households to help them finance their repairs. And interestingly, a little known part of that program is that you can borrow a little bit more money to build your home back safer and better. So, for example, if you wanted to elevate your home a little bit higher out of the floodplain so that next time the waters come, you're less likely to get damaged, you can get a loan for that. But it is a loan. The rate is subsidized, but it does have to be repaid. It's not free money.
And do we have any sense, though, some people qualify for those loans, some people don't. Do we have any sense of how many people are left completely exposed here, like on their own for recovery?
It's hard to know at this point. FEMA's already, I think, processed about 40,000 applications for their individual assistance grant program, and I haven't seen numbers from the SBA yet. But certainly Congress is going to step in with some sort of supplemental legislation, too. So there might be even more aid coming to the victims.
Carolyn Kuski, Director of Policy Research and Engagement at the Wharton Risk Center at the University of Pennsylvania. Thanks for walking us through it.
Yeah, thank you.
All week long, we've been seeing footage of dazed evacuees gathering in flood shelters in the U.S. state of Texas. Hurricane Harvey has forced nearly 2 million people from their homes in population-dense Houston, America's fourth largest metropolitan area. Scores of people have lost their lives, and the final bill for reconstruction that Texas will have to face in the weeks, months, and years to come is still unclear. Preliminary estimates put the economic cost at $190 billion, making it the costliest natural disaster in U.S. history. That figure amounts to a full 1% of U.S. GDP. Many people with waterlogged homes and businesses have no flood insurance. And if you don't have any insurance, then charity and government aid from the taxpayer-funded Federal Emergency Management Agency is your only option. Well, the concentration of U.S. energy assets in this low-lying area means that there are also big implications for the global oil and gas industry. Harvey swamped one-third of U.S. refining capacity. It could be weeks before refineries return to full operation, so there are huge concerns about fuel supplies. And the U.S. is the world's largest oil consumer. This explains why the price of refined products like gasoline are jumping higher. Prices for U.S. crude, though, are headed in the other direction. That's because disruptions are keeping refineries from buying oil to make products like jet fuel, diesel and gasoline. Harvey, which was the most powerful storm to hit Texas in half a century, shut the Colonial Pipeline, carrying fuel from the Gulf Coast refining hub to the East Coast, Europe and Mexico, who also import fuel from the Gulf of Mexico. And it's also worth noting, this is the first major storm to test U.S. shale since drilling took off around a decade ago. The Permian Basin is the largest U.S. shale field, and pipelines there have been shut. So big questions about how quickly that sector can make a comeback. Well, the petrochemical plant in Crosby is just one of many hazards that the Gulf Coast of Texas faces after Harvey. Even though it lies at the center of America's oil and gas industry, Houston has no zoning law and, according to watchdogs, minimal oversight on industrial pollution. As Shihab Ratansi reports now, this all makes dealing with the aftermath of Harvey even more of a challenge.
The Gulf Coast is full of neighborhoods like this one in Port Arthur, where children play among the smokestacks of refineries and petrochemical plants. Al Jazeera visited this town before it was flooded by Tropical Storm Harvey. It's in the shadow of the U.S.'s largest oil refinery. Port Arthur is nicknamed Cancer Alley due to its residents' elevated levels of cancer and respiratory problems. And despite Saudi Aramco's assertions that toxic emissions have been cut drastically at this plant, local residents aren't convinced.
When I come outside and I hit a bell, I'd be like, oh, they released something. And I go in the house and close the door back.
Harvey has meant the refinery has shut down, along with many other oil, gas, and petrochemical installations on the Gulf. And when operations are halted, the companies then burn off excess chemicals straight into the air. Over the last few days, the Environmental Defense Fund has looked into these industries' filings to regulators and has calculated that more than 2 million pounds of hazardous fumes have been released into the air since Harvey. The problem is there's no way to independently verify those regulatory submissions. The region's air quality monitors were all switched off to avoid storm damage, and environmental groups are skeptical.
I don't think that historically we can trust what industry is telling us in terms of what has been emitted. I think even if you look at the Exxon Baytown facility, recent judgment in terms of violating the Clean Air Act over 16,000 times, I think that tells a very good story.
Texas prides itself on being business-friendly. Cities like Houston don't even have official zoning laws, which is one reason why low-income communities live adjacent to the toxic smokestacks and why so many plants are built in locations vulnerable to coastal flooding.
Here we see the center of the oil refining industry itself being impacted by our addiction to oil.
Politicians in both Texas and Washington, D.C. say now is not the time for environmental politics. But a storm of Harvey's ferocity had long been predicted by climate scientists when the sky was clear, with little interest from those same politicians, which is why many argue now is exactly the time for a debate about regulation and climate change. Shihab Ratansi, Al Jazeera, Beaumont, Texas.
Joining us now from London is Amrita Sen. Amrita is co-founder and chief oil analyst at London-based Energy Aspects. Amrita, good to have you with us on Counting the Cost. Are we likely to see fuel shortages of refined gasoline products on the east coast of the States, in Europe, as a result of Harvey?
I think there will be some fuel shortages locally, for sure. And as a result of that, you are seeing Europe now ship a lot of gasoline over to the United States and over to Latin America as well. The U.S. usually sends diesel to Europe. It doesn't send gasoline. It's the other way around. Europe sends gasoline over to the U.S. There's obviously been severe disruptions in the products market. Nearly 4 million barrels per day of refining capacity was offline till yesterday. Some refineries are coming back. That will help. The EPA in the U.S. has also waived a lot of the specification tightness. So that will again help, because then even off-spec material can be delivered into the U.S. But yes, right now, the major pipeline that goes from the U.S. Gulf Coast, where Hurricane Harvey hit, to the U.S. East Coast has been shut because they don't have enough products to supply. And therefore, it is likely what you're going to see is that inventories are drawn down a lot. Right now, there's enough in stock. But if it persists for longer, then there's a risk of shortages. It's not there right now.
Tell us how that was.
4 feet of water to go get them food on the first day. Yeah, that's a lot of shit.
But y'all sitting here, y'all trying to interview people during their worst times. Like, that's not the smartest thing to do. Like, people are really breaking down, and y'all sitting here with cameras and microphones trying to ask us what the fuck is wrong with us.
So I'm so
and
sorry,
you're really trying to understand it with the microphone still in my face, sorry. With me shivering cold, with my kids wet, and you still putting a microphone
sorry,
in my face.
Sorry.
Russell Flores.
The stars at night are big and bright.
He's in the heart of Texas.
Context of white supremacy. Gusty Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Saturday, September 2nd, 2017. So I have been told. GTT. Compensatory call-in. If folks have commentary, observations, counter-racist suggestions you would like to share, feel free to dial in the number 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. Number again, 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. A few things to touch on before we get to the callers. We would not be broadcasting today if the horrendous flooding and catastrophe in Houston, Texas, if that had not occurred, we would probably not be broadcasting today. I had two wisdom teeth extracted on Thursday, and obviously that was not the most enjoyable experience and made a lot of things, talking a bit more challenging, many things. I did not broadcast that Thursday. I reported on my Facebook page about my extraction, and we did not do the workplace racism on Thursday. I did not do the book club on Friday. Thankfully, later in the day yesterday, the bleeding stopped. Thankfully, that was obviously not enjoyable, but that stopped. I did not have a lot of pain with the procedure, but the bleeding definitely made lots of things difficult, but that stopped. I just reported what was happening to the folks at the dental office, and they said that's pretty normal. It can normally last a few days. It can last 3-4 days. Thankfully, it stopped early, and their recommendation was to do nothing. Just go sit down, go take a nap, just try to do as little as possible, and I did what they said, but the bleeding stopped, so I was able to broadcast today. Thus, we're on, but that's why we were not on the last 2 days, and again, we probably wouldn't have been on if things had not happened down in Texas. The cows, we have a lot of listeners, and we've enjoyed a lot of guests from the Texas area on our program over the years, and I just had to think about it. I know Texas has been a spot we've always had a lot of listeners, but I think I said it last week. I said it on our Facebook page. Thoughts, prayers to all the folks down there. Even the more that I thought about it, even thinking individually, Hakima, she was on the program right at the end of 2016, the program with she and Chantel, where we were talking about quote-unquote biracial daughters, racist mothers, if folks recall that broadcast. But she, not only is she a non-white mother, but she is a Houston resident. She's been dealing with all this as well. Hope she and her family, her child, are doing well and are safe in dealing with all this. But just horrendous situation, and the racism, white supremacy on full display in this situation as well. Even the last report that you, or yeah, I think it was the last report that you heard where they were talking about because Houston is not zoned, you can have a refinery and all these companies that are just dumping poisons into the air. You can have that right across the street from a residential area, and it was all black people. There's video to the footage, to the audio that you heard of that. It was all black people. When you heard the resident, the homeowner, when she came on, she said that, oh yeah, I open the door and I hear the siren, and that lets me know that that, you know, they're releasing something into the air. So I just closed the door. That was a black female, and it looked like nothing but black people lived in the area that they tagged Cancer Alley. Racism, white supremacy on full display. I think they even had a report where white people were allegedly posing as looters to describe this area. Same type of thing that they did with Katrina. I even thought about that. The Washington Post, they had a huge story. We spent a lot of time covering Hurricane Katrina. I'd say that's probably a signature Cal's coverage, what we did for the 10-year anniversary of Hurricane Katrina. But they had a big report. Houston, that's one of the areas that got a huge number of so-called Katrina evacuees. You have a whole lot of people who got hit with Katrina, permanently relocated to Houston, and then got hit with Hurricane Harvey. Probably a whole lot of black people who are in that category. Some of them are even in Spike Lee's documentary, When the Levees Broke, and the follow-up as well. But you can see some of them. That's exactly the path that they took. So, man, cataclysmic devastation. A few other quick things to get to as we proceed. GTT, again, gone to Texas. If folks recall from Edward Baptist, the half has never been told. That was one of the first things that came to mind as I was watching the coverage and seeing everything play out over the past week. GTT, that used to be the phrase that whites would use when they were going to abscond. They weren't going to pay their debts. And so they would take up their enslaved niggers and leave Mississippi or North Carolina or South Carolina or wherever they were. Their farm had gone bust. GTT, gone to Texas. Few other quick things. So this summer, it has been the best of times, the worst of times. Back pain that I had have dealt with for a month. The wisdom teeth extraction, it's been horrendous, has been also great. Got to see the eclipse and had a lot of cool things happen as well. But best of times, worst of times. So the worst of times this week, Wednesday, day before my extraction, I'm out, passenger in a vehicle. We're motoring through Seattle on the highway, and suspected race soldier, he pulls over a vehicle in front of us. So he pulls over the vehicle. He hops out of his police car as he's pulled over this other vehicle. And as we're driving by, we're just looking, you know, at all this because it's happened right in front of us. And then he points at our vehicle. Like, he's pretty close. I think we're in the lane right next to the shoulder. So he points directly at our vehicle. It's like, you, over. Really aggressive, you know, how they can be. So, oh man. So we pull over. It's just two of us in the vehicle, both non-white. I obviously black male, driver, non-white, non-black male. We sit on the curb. Officer comes up, says, you know, back up the vehicle. We back up. He goes back to address the first car. So we're sitting. He's thinking, you know, what did I do? What, you know? And so I look over, he's not wearing his seatbelt. I shake my head because this is something, I think I have said this at the end of the Cals when I do my sobriety would be best and, you know, all of that. I frequently included buckle up, and my reason being easy things. These are simple things that we can do to counter racism, white supremacy. Let's see if we can minimize some of the contact we have with enforcement officials. Anything to minimize that, because those things can easily spiral out of control. And you see that all the time. Anything. If you can buckle up, hey, let's do that. I say this on the radio program. I nag the individual that I was riding with all the time and other family members. Buckle up. I try to use every excuse I can think of. Have you gotten tickets before? These people all understand racism, white supremacy. They've read Mr. Fuller's literature. I try to go that route. Hey, Every time you get a ticket, they've been ticketed for this before. Every time you get a ticket, that's cash to race soldiers. Yeah, I know. Yeah, I know. That's right. That's true. Yeah, I know. Every time you get a ticket, you're funding races. Yeah, I know. Yeah, and still no buckle up. I try to go the family route. You are an uncle. You have relatives, children in your family who care about you, who depend on you. Yeah, I know. Yeah, I know. And they still don't. I try every tactic I can take. I nag. I nag about this all the time because it's so simple. Lo and behold, why are we pulled over? No seatbelt. Buckle up. Every time you were in the vehicle, and everybody, because when he pulled us over, he got a ticket for not wearing his seatbelt. I did not, because I was buckled up. And the really tacky part about all this, he comes to the passenger side because we're on the highway, which means he's on my side of the vehicle. I'm not even driving, but I'm the one that's like, I'm having to do the interaction for all this because he's on my side. And then, in addition to not having his seatbelt on, the driver didn't have proof of insurance. As I said, these things can spiral out of control. So now, since he doesn't have his card, he's got to go and get on the phone and, you know, call. You can call the insurance agent and they can verify, which was true. He did have insurance, thankfully. But the officer is like, you know, and easily that could be the case. The officer be like, I'm not calling anybody. You don't have proof. Whammo, that's a ticket. Or that can be a jailable offense, depending on where you are. Discretion. I think somebody talks about that regularly. Anyway, so the officer, instead of all that, he does this route. He says, hey, I don't want to hear all that. And I'm not calling anybody because that was offered. You know, you can call the agency and verify. And he's like, I'm not doing all that. I don't know who's on the other end of the line. That could be your brother or cousin or something. Isn't that right? Talking to me and nudging me like I'm supposed to be in on the joke, like that could be his brother or cousin, right? Ha ha ha. Get out of here. Anyway, here's your $125 ticket for no seatbelt. And then he turns to me again. Thank you, sir, for wearing your seatbelt. Easily could have been way worse, which the driver acknowledged. Easily could have been way worse for all parties involved over something so simple. Buckle up, everything, and thank God everybody in the vehicle was sober. Thank God. Buckle up every single time you are in a vehicle. Everybody, driver, passenger, everybody. That should be a really easy counter-racist suggestion. And that wasted, it took about 30 minutes of our day where neither of us had 30 minutes to spare. I'm counting down the hours to a wisdom tooth extraction, two of them. And he had massive things to do, and that cost a time and energy. Simple things you can do to push back against race soldiers doing this to non-white people. And I'm really sure, because we had to slow down when you pulled over the other vehicle, this happened in front of us and it was traffic anyway, so we weren't going the normal highway speed. I super think he was able to look at us and get a good look. Oh, two non-white people. Oh, bam. I think that's exactly what happened. I think if we had been going at normal speed, no problem. But because everybody, the traffic flow was going so slow and he got a good long look at the motorists, I think that's what happened. Practicing racism, white supremacy while wearing a badge. The segment that the Young Turks did on Josh Abbott, race soldier who lied without a badge, who lied and said that he got stabbed by a black guy. Because, you know, he looked like a Nazi or what have you. It turned out he lied. That should be a false report. I didn't hear them saying that he was going to be arrested or what have you. That should be a false report. He should be charged, I hope. The other part, the Young Turks, in my view, they really minimized the fact that he said a black guy did this. To go the other route and all this nonsense and try to do his fake mea culpa sync doing an original story about this and saying that it happened. And then this guy lied, and why did he do it, and doing a psychoanalysis. Make sure we do not downplay, oh yeah, he did practice racism, white supremacy, in accusing a black guy of doing this, which is, they've written whole books about this, the fabricated blame a black person. Standard operating procedure. Other tidbit, that segment on Oregon. The reason that I included that on this week with everything that happened down in Texas, and there were many other things. The reason that I included that, the school year is starting. Absolutely right. I could have included a segment easily on the numbers of schools in Houston that are being closed and how that's impacting children. Very, very important. But that segment in Oregon, two reasons. Number one, I think it's always great for Black parents and Black people in general to get a reminder of the wonders that are waiting Black boys and girls in public schools. The second reason is that that is huge. Practicing racism, one of the huge byproducts of an environment of racism, white supremacy, you have a whole lot of child rape and just all sorts of sexual depravity. I think Cynical African might give me a second on that, cynicalafrican.com. That sort of conversation needs to be had with your child on a regular basis. If you are going to, you know, go ahead and send them to the killing fields, you need to be having that sort of conversation about what they should be mindful of, aware of when they're in that environment, what to do, be on lookout. I mean, that needs to be a thorough conversation had with girls and boys regularly, because that is, as they said in the report, very widespread, not a one-time thing. And this is Oregon, so I suspect that could have been all white people. Probably could have been. Oregon is a super white state, but that pattern of conduct is very widespread. That is not local to Oregon at all. That is worldwide white conduct. That said, the number to dial, 641-715-3640, the code 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. For this program specifically, exclusively, if we could not use metaphors, I would appreciate it. Racists, regularly, that's one of the ways that they practice racism. They will use a lot of analogies, comparisons, where they are comparing two items that are not similar or equivalent at all. They'll do this on a regular basis. That's one way that you generate confusion. Non-white people, we've been exposed to that for years. And many of us, Gusty Renegade included, we are still learning. We have not come to conclusions on some things. As a result, sometimes we will use a metaphor in the hope that that will convey our thoughts. It does not frequently. It just produces more confusion, and it does not add to our understanding. If we cannot use metaphors, just be direct, explicit about what it is that we would like to say, that would be grand. I would appreciate it, and I will prompt about that. That said, folks who dialed in, if you could watch the background noise, that would be super appreciated. If you know you're in a loud, noisy environment, if you could use your mute button, that would be great. Just help us preserve the quality of the broadcast. If we have any folks that are in the Texas area and you have any commentary updates you would like to share, that would certainly be appreciated. And again, prayers, thoughts, cows, listeners, supporters, guests who are in the area impacted by the storm. I hope you all are safe and dealing with things as best you can. I cannot even imagine. We'll go ahead, get to the phone lines. Again, first few folks who dialed in with a hand up, line should be open.
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Hi, Black female calling from Georgia. I just wanted to speak on the Cobb County officer, the clip, give an update on that. The officer was initially supposedly suspended, and then he was so-called fired. And then the most recent that had to do with that case was he was retired. So Cobb County allowed him to retire, which means he will receive all the benefits that he would normally receive if he retired opposed to being fired. I just wanted to give an update on that. Thanks.
That's like a total transfer. What is it? I think Mr. Fuller, another one of his infamously coined, for, well, I shouldn't say infamous. I think we had a great tutorial on the difference between famous and infamous by Red in Ohio. One of his famous and constructive phrases is, white people don't get fired, they get transferred. In this case, he did not get fired. He got retired, which is substantially different, as our black mother in Georgia just pointed out. Appreciate the update. Do we have other folks who dialed in with a hand up? Due to my medical condition, I will ask one thing. One way you can support the cows this week is to not spectate. If you dialed in with a hand up, to go ahead and chat. That way I don't have to do as much talking. Thank you kindly. So the folks, lots of them with hands up, proceed.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Black male calling from Texas, northern Texas, so I wasn't affected directly by the storm. There were, I noticed on my way home from work on Thursday, signs about gas stations not having any gas. I knew that wasn't true. I didn't worry about filling up. I just went about my business normally. And as it was later reported, there actually was not a gas shortage. And some of those prices were inflated. So, you know, I was just noticing that, you know, the tricky ways in which prices can be affected. But I have two, have had a seatbelt incident, which is really interesting in Texas, Amarillo specifically, in which I was headed towards Dallas and I saw a police officer driving westbound when I was driving eastbound, and then officer crossed the median behind me. And I noticed the officer, I was already doing less than the speed limit, try to minimize contact that way. The officer pulled up next to me on the driver's side and made his car parallel with mine and looked into my window. I looked at the officer, and before the officer could even put his lights on, I just pulled over. The first thing, I just pulled over. Had my insurance out and my driver's license. I have a special wallet I call my police wallet that can only hold those two things. It is paper thin, so I don't have to fumble in my car, in my glove box. Officer came to the passenger side window and said, the reason I pulled you over was to see if you were wearing your seatbelt, but I already see it. You have your seatbelt on, so I can't write you a ticket for that. But since I turned my lights on, I have to write something down for a report. And I thought that was really interesting that the officer did that. I did not know if that was a common practice or not. But you know, even when you are, you know, abiding by the law, those types of things can happen. And they are going to happen to non-white people. And so I wanted to comment on that. As far as the Young Turks, I was listening to that segment, and I find it really interesting that another technique that white people use to practice racism is that they will speak rather quickly. And in the process of them speaking rather quickly, whether it's on purpose or not, the result is that it leads to not being specific and truthful and factual, is that nebulous language will come out. It will not be specific enough, or the false comparison. So the part during the Turks segment, they were talking about the white woman who was scared of the police officer, and they equated slight hand movements with, what did they say? They said equating slight hand movements with a high-speed chase. They were equating that with, I guess it was a white man. Can't remember in what state that was, but it led police on a high-speed chase, and he was shot. And I don't see that as the equivalent of a black person actually following the commands and still being shot by police. So, you know, I thought that was, they were practicing a racism, white supremacy, and adding to the confusion. And even if on the occasion that white people are getting killed, you know, there, one thing I think that a lot of people get confused is that the idea that it is a requirement that racists 100% only negatively affect non-white people. It actually gives more legitimacy to the system when here and there on occasion the law can be applied more equal. I didn't say equal, I said more equal, just to give the appearance that it will be, because white people do go to jail, but still, on average, they don't go to jail just as long. So, you know, there's just some things I noticed during the section, and I will allow.
Other folks who dialed in with a hand up that we've not heard from, if you have commentary, proceed.
May I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Hello, thank you for taking my call, and hello to everyone. This is Red in Ohio. I just wanted to give an update about the situation with the non-white female in her apartment. I already explained about how there was a cockroach infestation, and the leasing office, they were basically nonchalant about the whole thing. On Monday, she had gotten, she had finally gotten in contact with the office because they were closed over the weekend. And the woman at the office, a white woman, I might add, she definitely was taking the situation as a joke. She said, oh, the cockroach of the refrigerator. And which I thought was, you know, of course, tacky. All they, and like I said before, they were, all they offered was to bomb the apartment. And there was nothing that the non-white person could do as far as losing money out on the apartment. So at least she was able to, with the help of her family, be able to move her stuff out. And she has to still continue to bomb her stuff in a storage before she can actually move it somewhere else. So I just thought that that was just a way that, you know, there are just so many different, I feel like there are different hidden taxes that we have imposed upon us rather than just not being paid as much as white people. I was also thinking about that with my situation when I had recently gone to the doctor because I had like this pain for several months. I went to the specialized doctor who was a white man. I didn't feel comfortable going to him. I finally was able to go to my regular doctor who is a black female. And of course this is costing me money even though I do have health insurance through my job. But I'm still having to pay out of pocket, of course. And I was in the going to just the primary care physician, the black female. She was able to help me with the pain, gave me some medication, made the pain go away. And I asked her, well, why wouldn't the specialty doctor do that same thing? And she put it in a way, well, if he tested for certain things and all the tests came up negative, then he was just taking a clinical approach to it. But if had something that he did not test for, it just didn't make sense. So basically wasting my time and my money because you didn't test for a certain ailment or whatever. So I just thought that that was interesting. There was another article. They've been having basically articles in the Columbus Dispatch, which is typically the newspaper that I read. My relatives get it, so I can just get it from them for free. So they have been having like articles about the opioid crisis. And this time they were speaking about how basically the opioid crisis here links to Florida. And because like white people, they will send their drug addict children to Florida to these treatment centers to get help, or quote unquote. And apparently these some treatment centers in Florida are actually defrauding the government. And a couple of things from the article really quick was that not only are these treatment centers, they are getting, one of the tactics are they, they get the people off of drugs, but then they also have like drug dealers basically that they work with to get these patients back onto drugs. So that way they have a steady income. And one of these Florida, it's the Florida Recovery Centers, it's called a halfway there Florida home. They collected, it says they collected almost $19 million by fraudulently billing insurance companies for over $58 million over 4 years, according to the FBI, which I thought was interesting. So I'm assuming, I have not done that much research, but it kind of seems like that wouldn't be something that a non-white company could do. But again, that's just speculation. The last thing that I wanted to touch on was just some of the things from the article. From the segment. I thought that it was interesting about the segment about the OPB. One of the interviewers, when it came to the allegations of child abuse, how he said, well, these were some head-shaking moments, which we're referring to child abuse, which I feel like it should be more than just a head-shaking moment. And it just made me think about how I've been speaking to, among other things, I have been thinking about the hurricane, but I had spoken to my non-white female relative, and she has a child going to an Afrocentric, African-centered school here, and she's been, and the child has a non-white, has a white man as a teacher. And the teacher told her, my relative who's a parent, he said, oh, I always pick out one child every year. And this year it happened to be my family member. And I told my family member, you should really make sure, you should really keep an eye out on this. If this person, he's in a school where there's majority black children, and he always has like a special child that he likes to, you know, give more attention to. This is something that just should not be like a, you should not be grateful that he wants to pay attention to your child. You should really, you know, make sure that this is not something that, you know, this can be bad for the child. And she was like, oh, I just don't want to think about that. But it just made me think about, you know, that segment. That's all I have for now. Thank you for letting me share.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir. Good to hear from you, Roz.
Hey, greetings to you, Gus, to all the callers and the listeners. It's good to have you back. I didn't know that you actually had the issue with the wisdom tooth extraction. I had that done when I was 18, and they gave me surgery and took out all four of them, and it was terrible. So what I did, I don't know if you got the email I sent you recently, because I figured you might have been, maybe resting, but I did send you Violetta's tea. And I sent you a T-ball. You should have gotten a T-ball a couple of days ago. The tea should be coming by early next week. And basically, you can get the ball and you can steep it so that you can actually utilize the tea to help you with your pain and discomfort. And then I also, tonight, I sent you some high-concentration colloidal silver that you can dilute. And I sent you a spray bottle. You can put it in when you dilute it, and you can spray it in the areas where you had the surgery, and it is really great for inflammation, and it is the world's most powerful disinfectant. It kills germs, fungus, bacteria, viruses, you name it. Matter of fact, before the medical field developed antibiotics, it was colloidal silver that was used as the universal germ killer for its properties. So that you should have by, I believe, they said that because it's about three different items I sent you. So, and I sent you also oil of oregano tablets, because oil of oregano is one of the most powerful natural antibiotics, and it's also great for inflammation as well. So you can take that in combination with the silver, and it should accelerate your healing process a lot faster. So you should get those by September 4th and 5th. So I'm thinking by early to mid next week at the latest. I just wanted to update you with that, and hopefully, you get well as quickly as possible. excuse me. In reference to the clips, the clip with the Cherokee black female who was a Cherokee, Cherokee descent, I just found it so interesting that she discussed the fact that the vast majority of people who are recognized as Cherokee are basically $5 Indians. When she said that they had a card, that's the card that basically, white people who would basically tell these stories about, one of their ancestors raped some indigenous person, so they're part Cherokee, and they ended up paying $5 to get the card, and they get the benefits of being considered Cherokee without actually being Cherokee. She also discussed the fact that they didn't even know the culture or the language or anything. These are just basically white people who were living their lives as white people who were getting the benefits of being and it's considered a Native American. So it's just funny, again, that there's white supremacy even in that situation where these white people are dictating who's considered Native American and they're not Native American themselves. So that's how the system works. When you dominate people, you can do whatever you want. This clip about the Oregon teacher who was raping students basically for 30 plus years, it's only in the system of white supremacy that you can have a situation where a teacher's had multiple verifiable allegations of child rape, and they just transfer them, or they transfer from school to school. For some reason, they quote unquote go into, well, not even going to say that, they're basically missed by law enforcement. And the only reason they're missed by law enforcement is because they're white. If they weren't white, they would have been put in jail 30 years ago. And because they're white, they're given the benefit of the doubt to continue raping young females, to the point where I think I heard one group collectively had 14 girls who chose to come to school in inappropriate gym clothes just so that he wouldn't look at their backsides and their breasts. That is really interesting. So the whole discussion, what to me, as far as the way that the news reported it, was very much biased on the side of the actual pedophile perpetrator. And it's just, again, the system of white supremacy. In reference to the hurricane, I was going to implore people to, if you drive, to stock up on gas, because gas is going to start to really, really skyrocket in the areas that get their gas from the Gulf area. There was an article I read that said that definitely New York and New Jersey is going to be affected. Earlier today, there was an article that said Boston's gas prices had already spiked, and potentially nationwide it can spike to as high as $2.79 a gallon. Also, I found it interesting that the famous mega church white supremacist by the name of Joel Osteen basically locked his doors to the people that were fleeing the hurricane, most of them black patrons of his church, with which he makes, from what they said, he makes about $90 million a year in tithes. He's a 501c3, so he doesn't pay taxes on that money. And he's worth at this time $67 million. But yet the only reason he opened the doors was because he was exposed by the black people he rejected for practicing racism. So they don't feel shame. They just get, they're upset because they get caught, and they'll react in a way that's seemingly non-racist because they've been exposed for being the racist that they are. So I think just that the patrons of his church should literally have that church shut down, and he should not have a 501c3 status if he's going to basically steal money from these people. And in their most desperate situation, he closed the door in their faces. Also, one of the show hosts at Black Talk Radio, Black Rose, she's actually in the middle of Houston where this is taking place. Thank goodness she's safe at this time. But one of the other radio show hosts, Ando, has information on where, if people want to donate, you can donate clothing, also money that can go directly to the people. So it's not like the Red Cross, where only 1 cent of every dollar actually goes towards helping people. In the locations that Dave is dealing with are people on the ground directly connected with the people who are suffering. So that way, all the money that's sent goes directly to the people that need it. If you send clothes, if you're sending supplies, it'll go directly to the people that need it. So I just wanted to throw that information out there as well. And lastly, I just wanted to say about the white woman who was afraid of being shot. I just find it interesting because that police officer basically revealed the nationwide code when it comes to dealing with black people. We only kill black people. And he only got in trouble for revealing the code, because this is something that's practiced everywhere in this country and everywhere that white people dominate, which is globally. And a person put up on BTR an article that's talked about 14 precincts across the United States that have lived up to what that officer talked about, because they only killed the year of 2017 thus far, no white people. So again, let's take this seriously, that they're out to get us, they're killing us, they're pulling us over, you know, just to check it if you're not wearing a seatbelt. So these are the types of things that, like Gus was saying, we need to be preemptive about in regards to preventing contact with these people, so that, and I put people in quotes, so that we don't have to suffer any more than we suffer already. I believe there was also incidences in the hurricane of people being shot at again when trying to escape the flood, similar to Danziger Bridge and other incidences we heard of in Louisiana. So I wish those people safety. I'll be sending, donating as well, you know, things, clothing, things like that and whatnot, and also money to them, hopefully, to help these people heal and repair. So I just wanted to throw that information out there. I say to you, Gus, I wish you a speedy recovery, and I hope you get well. I hope things that I said to you help you, and peace and love to everyone. Thank you. I'll mute my line.
Much
can I be heard?
Yes, sir. We can hear you.
Hello?
In Alabama. Yes, sir, Alabama. We can hear you.
Yes, Gus, glad you, been kind of rough month for you, wasn't it, Gus? Glad you're back. I'm celebrating, yesterday was my 2 years being clean and drug free for 2 years. I like to thank the cows. You helped me out a whole lot during my recovery. I know during my active addiction, I probably would have been laughing at the cows, you know, calling crazy Negroes, and nobody might want to hear all that. But I'm glad I came in. When I sobered up, I was able to absorb and internalize everything that I learned from the cows, and it helped me out a great deal. Made me more aware. I don't watch TV no more. About 2 years of not watching TV. I get discouraged sometimes because I try to talk to my friends about it. They call me crazy, man. The usual. You crazy? How you can't sit up and watch TV, man, and all this and that. But, you know, I survived through it and everything. But, glad you're back, Gus. Hang on in there. And I think I haven't heard from North Dakota, if I'm correct. He was from Houston. You remember the caller from North Dakota, Gus? I think he was from Houston.
I believe that is correct. He's one of the folks. That's why I said we have a lot of folks who are listeners who are from that area. But I think, yeah, he said he lived in that area and moved up to North Dakota. I think you're correct.
Well, thanks for letting me share.
Yes, sir. Thank you. Roz, I got the mesh T-ball, and much obliged for the items and encouragement. Appreciate that, Roz. Other folks we've not heard from, if you have a hand up, line should be open. And the spectators, once again, the spectators. So the other folks with a hand
up. I'm sorry.
Is this Red?
This is Red. I just want to add something really quick. I apologize. I was able to look up the owner of the halfway there home in Florida, and he is a white man. He seems like he would be considered a white man. I just wanted to add that. Thank you.
For sure. Confirmation.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Awesome. This is Ken Steele, and I am en route to somewhere in Los Angeles. I'm not quite sure where I am, but I will say I have a quick question. I believe it's the caller from Houston. Is the caller from Houston familiar with program called Star in the Morning or Live and Direct or Shot 97, either any of those? I'm just curious.
I thought we had a caller from Texas on. I'm not sure if he said he was actually in Houston. Was that the guy? Was the male caller? Is that the person you're talking about?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir. I believe so. Yes.
No, I do not live in Houston. I am from Houston.
No, I my apologies. I guess I'm getting the people mixed up. It's the person who is celebrating their 2-year anniversary.
Well, he's in Alabama.
I think that's the person I was.
He referenced a person in Houston.
My mistake. My mistake. My apologies. Anyway, I just wanted to say for this week, you know, the situation in Houston is getting worse by the day, and it's getting more dangerous by the day. There are increasing reports of these so-called rescue workers being tied to various white supremacist groups. I know that there was one group called the Proud Boys that was down there taking pictures and toting guns, sporting, AR-15s or the Bushmaster, the one that's responsible for a number of the mass shootings. So I'm really torn about recommending anybody go down there because to me it just seems like it's only going to get worse and it's only going to get violent. And I'm hearing that militia groups are forming. They were talking about a Cajun Navy, you know, that was being assembled to serve as rescue parties. And I can only see that these organized groups of bearded white supremacists who oddly look like contractors, a lot of them look like contractors, could eventually take over government services in some of these areas. That whole Houston situation to me is if they don't have it under control, it could easily deteriorate into something that it quickly into something that is a threat that all the victims in that area need to take heed to. And if they can get out, I would just get out. That whole situation, oh man. And then if there's one good thing that came of this situation is that it truly exposed Joel Osteen for the racist that he is. And if there are any victims that are following him, my suggestion is to, you know, minimize contact with those victims because that whole situation is ungodly. I honestly, like, if you are connected in any way to Christianity or you are aware of, you know, what is actually written in the Bible, that right there is a perfect display of what they call the devil at work. So, you know, this racist, this arch racist, this white supremacist, you know, if there are people that are following him, victims of racism, I wouldn't waste time trying to convince them or trying to save them or trying to, trying to convince them that the system of racism is a problem. Just recognize that you're dealing with somebody who would willingly collaborate with someone who is openly practicing some of the most egregious and public displays of racism that we've seen in play out in the public. So I guess that's my contribution for now. Thanks for letting me talk. And Gus, I'm glad to hear that you are recovering well. Back surgery is very serious, so it's good that you're doing well. Thanks.
My goodness, please let us, I did not have back surgery. Woo, do not put that in the ether. I just had my wisdom teeth extracted. No back surgery, just had the wisdom teeth extracted.
Oh, my apologies.
Woo,
sorry about that. I just listened in and I heard that that was with your back and the surgery. And I was just like, wow, that's pretty serious. But wisdom teeth extraction. Well, it's good to hear that you're talking and glad to hear that you're having a good recovery.
Right on. Much obliged. Much obliged. Congrats as well to Big Victim in Alabama. 2 years being sober. Say that also. Sobriety would be best. Outstanding to hear you are taking good care of yourself, sir. Other folks we've not heard from at all, if you have a hand up, proceed.
May I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Peace to you, Gus, the host. Peace to everybody listening. I have to be a little bit short tonight because I'm a bit under the weather, but also I am in the middle of doing work. I only have, well, let me first start off with the clips. Every single clip I hear from the Young Turks, it seems every single week we get away from Barack Obama's presidency. They are revealing themselves to be very closely aligned with racism and unapologetically so. Many people, I have read comments on YouTube and on several sites where who argue that they are not, that they do good work, that they are fighting a good fight. These comments, especially since Charlottesville, and their attempt to downplay the role of white supremacy, the role of white supremacists, and to somehow try to even anyway, it's very clear now what side they are actually working from and working on. I don't care how many black godchildren he claims. outside of all of that, the New York Times ran a hidden article. I call it hidden. It was buried on page 816 earlier in this week. I usually write the date on it. I didn't write the date on it. But the title of the article is called "Stepping Back from Plan for a Tubman $20 Bill," and one of the interesting points in here, a couple of them actually, the first one is how they recount how Donald Trump suggested that Harriet Tubman be placed on the $2 bill, which I hadn't heard that, but he had said that apparently before he was president, I guess. And they recounted very briefly that Tubman was, Obama actually suggested that Tubman be placed on the $10 bill, but public outcry changed his strategy to putting her on the reverse side of the $20 bill. This, I think, is interesting only because it has to do with Harriet Tubman. I live in a community where she is very, I'd like to say well revered, but I think she's a tourist attraction, basically. But she should be honored in the black community. We should definitely honor her. I truthfully don't care if she's on money. And in fact, I'd probably try to keep her off of the money so black people aren't confused about whose money it is and what it is used 4. I'm going to cut my commentary short right there. Thank you very much, Gus. I'm glad you're feeling better. I hope that as the week goes on, the pain lessens and, you know, you're able to get back to doing what you do very well for us. Thank you very much. Feel better.
Much obliged. Other folks, if you have a hand up and we've not heard from you, proceed.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
All right. Peace to the host, to the platform, to the callers. And I just wanted to chime in for a second about the current conditions that we've been witnessing lately, which in terms of politics, or if we had structure amongst ourselves, we would consider a state of emergency. Like most governments or most organized unions of people do. And, you know, what I've been noticing lately is that the political structure that we live in, you know, as far as being United States citizens and Democrats and Republicans and Klansmen and things like that, or other terrorists. You know, the politics that's playing out right now in racism, white supremacy, is very obvious when we consider some people terrorists, or we know that radical Islamic state people are terrorists, or if you're a Muslim, you can be considered a terrorist. But when we've seen what we saw with the white nationalists and all of that here lately, we've been seeing, you know, what I call hypocrisy, or what we should call hypocrisy, or what they call bias, or their mainstream word that they're using. But we just see this effect where we're talking about the terrorists like we don't talk about the other terrorists. I mean, the response to them is not the same, even from Black men who are believing whatever they believe. Me personally, I believe that what we believe in and what we dispute about is what keeps us stagnated as far as taking action physically. We spend so much time in dispute about things on intellectual level or metaphysical level that we barely take physical action. And standing up for your women and your children and your elders and your mothers and things like that in these type of conditions is okay to do, but we dispute about how we should do it. And I think that, you know, everything is showing itself very clear. You know, we should have the right to have our own country and our own government and our own police in our own communities, but Black people have different ideologies that keep them from coming together, and that's very obvious now. And I think that we should work more on coming together for, you know, replacing the system of racism, white supremacy with justice, even if it takes force or fighting. And, you know, most people's belief or non-belief in God or the Creator or Allah or whatever the people call it, that keeps us from either acting or not acting. And so in the face of demons and people who worship the devil or whatever, I think that we should take these things more serious. And so that's all I wanted to add. In the face of a system of sophisticated terrorism, and being a part of an occupied nation of people.
Other folks, if you dialed in, if you have a hand up, if we have not heard from you at all, you should speak now.
May I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Greetings, Gus. Glad to hear that you're feeling a little bit better. This is Jerry from Chattanooga. I came in late, but from what I have heard, you played the video on the $5 Indians. And this is very confusing to me because with the $5 Indians, we have this thing going on with Texas. Now, with the Indians being the indigenous people, but they have white people representing them, we know that Texas was occupied by white people because they wanted free, they wanted their slaves to be free. Here recently, Texas wanted to separate from the Union. And just with me doing my studies on HAARP and everything, right when the eclipse was going on, and I'm asking this because I'm wondering if anybody else paid attention to this, the government gave NASA the okay to release bacteria balloons in the air while the eclipse was going across the country, right when the hurricane was getting ready to set up. And then we find that it has hit. It's in the progress of hitting landfall three times with no signs of slowing down. And we also have to pay attention to the language that's being used when they're referencing so-called black people, African Americans, or what have you, whatever title we choose to designate ourselves with. They call us refugees and looters when they're speaking about these white people. On the other hand, they call them survivors. And one of the statements that was made by the Texas government is that if they caught anybody looting, they would shoot them on the spot. And they also deputized some of these organizations, like that Cajun Army that the other caller was speaking about. So they are giving these people free rein to murder these looters, which we know they're speaking of black people. And I just wanted to get your take on that, and if you have paid any of that any attention, although I know you have been going through your situation. If not only you, though, but the other callers, had anybody paid any of that any attention? And I'll mute my line.
With the looters and violence, I had not heard about an order to shoot to kill looters. I did see a report where white people were allegedly posing. They were making fake photographs that were alleging that black people were looting and running amok in Houston. And it turned out that that was not true. I did see that, but my extraction kind of messed up my week and my timing, but I had pitched I might be writing a report on that because I had said that is something people should remember from Hurricane Katrina, the work of A.C. Thompson that we talked about on this program before. He was a guest on this program, one of our first guests in 2009, Gary Rivlin, Katrina After the Flood, where they both document. In fact, A.C. Thompson, he did an 18-month investigation, his report on the white vigilantes in New Orleans, where white people came with the expressed purpose of committing violence against black people. And at least 11 black males were killed. That was verified. By gunshot wound, shot to the head, a lot of them, where it looked like, you know, just straight execution. A.C. Thompson reported on that. Frontline, they did that great documentary on PBS, Law and Disorder, that talked about a lot of this. The documentary, Welcome to New Orleans, has white people bragging about killing black people during Katrina. It was tons of reports. Democracy Now! Captured some of that. Gary Rivlin, Katrina After the Flood, he was a guest on our program as well. Well, he talked about that. I might be writing about that to say that's something that people should keep in mind when you have these type of events. You have a class of race soldiers. They look forward to this chaos. The same thing happens and they lock down Houston and, you know, deny you access to this area, or you end up having a lot of military personnel and National Guard coming in. You could just end up having a lot of armed whites in these areas, and an area with a lot of black people, hey, all you need, a white woman was raped, or, you know, any kind of call, and feel free to shoot any black people you need to. That happened in New Orleans. Would not surprise me at all if that was repeated in Houston. Other folks can reply to that as we proceed. Other people that we've not heard from, do we have any callers we've not heard from at all? Do we nab
any?
Oh, yes, sir. Go ahead.
Hi, yes, sir. Greetings to Gus, the host, the listeners and callers. And I just also wanted to say it's good to have you back, Gus. It's great to hear you. And I wanted to point out it was a part of the audio segment where I don't know if anyone caught this, but I think it was concerning the Houston, like flooding and things like that. And I think the guy he was interviewing, I don't know if that was the sheriff or something, but he had asked, the sheriff had said something about it. I guess something didn't hit Houston, and then he just rushed him off the interview. Like, was that what was on that audio segment? Do you remember that part, Gus?
Oh, I think that was the NPR segment where they were talking to the judge from Harris County in Texas about why they did not do the evacuation. And I think he was responding to the question. This was an NPR segment, and I think he was going to add more, and they cut him off. I think, or at least a part of what might have been happening there, was that segment was limited. I think they had about 7 minutes for the segment or whatever it was. And so the time for the segment was going out, because I've heard them do that before where they will kind of interrupt someone, just be like, that's all the time we have for today and we got to end. But that was I think that's the segment you're talking about with the judge from Harris County about why they didn't evacuate.
Oh, okay. So I was wondering why it kind of ended like that. I just wanted to make a update about down here at University of Florida, where Richard Spencer, he's still, I guess fighting with some kind of legal backup to come speak up, to come speak here on September the 12th. So the local news reported that it's been opened back up again. So I guess the university or whoever's going to represent the university is going to, I guess, possibly go through litigation about it or whatnot. So I guess they use the term National Policy Institute. So I guess they have some real powerful white people supporting this cause, I guess. So that's pretty much all I have for right now. Thank you.
Indeed. We have other folks who dialed in that we have not heard from. Any other folks that we missed completely?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Greetings, everyone. I would start off by saying I'm glad I didn't have any wisdom teeth to be taken out. Sounds pretty painful, and recover soon without the pain. I basically just have somewhat of an insight and have a question. As I've been looking at the Harvey disasters, I haven't seen what I have observed when I have been in Houston, the city of Houston in Texas, of the anything like the Third Ward, which is very urban. And what I mean by urban is that it has buildings. And some of the people don't necessarily stay in homes. I haven't seen that setting. Would some others on the line have not seen that sort of picture on the different showings of the disaster? Because I haven't.
Could you repeat that, please?
In Houston, there's a lot of non-white people, a lot of non-white black people, and in areas that has a name such as Third Ward. Has anybody seen any scenes from on the news from that particular area, the area similar to that in the city of Houston?
I don't know the areas well enough to know the parts of Houston that they're showing. I have been to Houston before, but I mean, it was only briefly and it was some time ago. But I have, in the reports that I've seen, I have been seeing a lot of black people. Like, if they showed me the spots, I couldn't recognize the ward or anything else. But I have seen a lot of black people in the images that they've been showing in areas that look like black. The image that I was talking about where they were saying, oh, yeah, this is Cancer Alley, that was filled with black people.
Okay. A lot of homes, residential, like residential areas or more city-like areas?
The Cancer Alley, this was a residential area, but it was a residential area across from an oil refinery with all the pollution and stuff. But yeah, it was a black residential area.
Okay. Well, I was just wondering, because I wondered if somebody had seen the more urban-like areas. I haven't seen that. And if so, I'm just wondering, maybe they didn't get the level of waters as some of these other areas got. Certainly didn't see some of the similar talk about looters versus survivors, which is code. Looters is code for non-white black people, and survivors are, of course, the white people. But just from the mere fact that there was a lot of people that had watercrafts, I would assume that most of those people were white people who had watercrafts for various reasons. Traditionally, I was about to say in this part of the world, but it's probably a lot of other places. Black people are restricted from areas that are close to water. And so therefore the activities that comes around water are not cultured to black people. It put it this way, in this part of the world, I know that is partly consistent, you know, like boats and different other watercraft. I'm not saying that some black people don't have those things, but I would say it's considerably low as opposed to with white people. Just some of my observations. Other than that, I don't have a whole lot more to report this week. Other than, you know, just from the standpoint of what I've been doing during the football season as a coach, sharing with primarily non-white black males on a daily basis. And that's all I have. Thank you.
Appreciate that, retired firefighter. Anybody that we missed, anybody have a hand up that we have not heard from at all? Grant, so we got everyone. We have about 30 minutes left in the broadcast. So if folks have any additional comments they want to make sure they get in, or if you are listening, I think you might have something you would like to share before things conclude, go ahead and get a hand up, 641-715-3640, the code 564-943-pound. Press *6 if you would like to participate. I did want to say something about that segment where they had the protests in Berkeley and they had the black journalist who intervened to save a suspected race soldier who had fallen and was being beaten by some other suspected racists. I have seen that sort of story before. I think they have an incident where a robed Klansman was being beaten and a black person intervened to save them, like whites love those sorts of stories, particularly when they can get a nice photograph showing a black person sacrificing themselves to shield and save some racist. They love those sort of incidents. I think it shows how well, I think for whites, the reason this shows how well we have conditioned our victims to behave. Look how successful we've been. But they love those sort of reports. And that rhetorical ethic, Dr. Marimba Ani Yorugu, where she talks about that, this notion that I recognize humanity in everybody, even in avowed enemies. I recognize their humanity, too, and that me behaving in this manner is somehow in my best interest. Somehow that's how we have been conditioned to think. Big part of why I've said for years, no helping white people. No helping white people. And a lot of people respond, you know, with revulsion to that very notion, which to me just shows how important that is to the maintenance of white supremacy. Non-white people, the majority of the people on the planet, helping white supremacists. No helping white people. Big tenant on the cows. Other folks have commentary they needed to get in?
I was going to say because just about every time I would go to my attempted mother's house, the television would be on the news, you know, with Harvey. And sometimes they have these, I call them special interest stories to try to, I guess with the idea of mine of thinking that people are going to get happy by seeing this particular type of report. And in this particular case, it was this very, very heavy set non-white black female, heavily melanated, nothing, I don't want to say anything negative. I'm just describing the image. And she was going around in one of the shelters singing Amazing Grace. And to me, when I see articles such as this, they meaning the white people, if a white person has anything to do with it, they're showing it from a stereotypical point of view, primarily. With the idea in mind, I would say, to make fun of non-white black people. That image just stuck in my head. She was as big as the non-white black female actress who was in that very negative movie. She was being abused. I never did watch it, so I just heard about it. I just can't think of the name of that movie where she was being abused constantly by her, I think her mother, that was played by a lady that yes, she was at least her size, maybe even bigger. An attractive appearance and very good singer, but she was going around, and primarily the people she was singing to in the shelters were old white people who, you know, who are old enough to have practiced racism and white supremacy for a long time. And she was going around, had a nice smile on her face, just singing Amazing Grace over and over and over again. And I just saw that image just shaking my head. I think that came out some like maybe Tuesday of this week, and it's still in my mind because I know they're not doing it for any constructive purposes. The white people are doing it for stereotypical negative purposes. Aunt Jemima type of thought process, I'm thinking. That's it.
May I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
I just wanted to add, I did actually, I have been
recently watching the Weather Channel, trying to stay away from like the NBCs, the, you know, Fox News and whatever. But I figured since the Weather Channel, since that's typically all they deal with is the weather, they would have, you know, at least a little bit more unbiased coverage, but of course not. They did show, they did have like basically one segment where there was a reporter speaking to an older Black male and just speaking about how he was able to get to a particular shelter and how his mother was able to get the care that she needed because she, I think she could not walk. And I thought that that was kind of odd. And then when I turned it on, as I kept watching, not long after that segment, and this is where it's kind of odd, is that they started to talk about how they were starting to, there's these groups or whatever, starting to save the animals. And they show like this white, I don't know if it was a veterinarian or not, but it was a white woman feeding a, it looked like a squirrel. So they were even talking about just the natural wildlife in Houston and how they were having people go out there and help this squirrels, which was just, it was appalling. So that's one of the main things that stuck out. It's like you show this segment with Black people and then how they're being helped, but then also you go back to, you know, animals. I had also just looked up, it's on CNBC.com under natural disasters. It says farmers CEO on Harvey, many owners of flooded homes may be in for a troubling surprise. And the CEO of Farmers, the Farmers Insurance, he's clearly a white man, at least what I would perceive as a white man. His name is Jeff Daly, and it does definitely remind me of Hurricane Katrina. They do reference Hurricane Katrina in this article. They said that they just talk about the losses that that were experienced in Hurricane Katrina, and then he did say that he's quoted saying, for our own book of business, maybe one in four of our homeowners actually selects the National Flood Insurance Program. And then he says, I think you'll see an awful lot of uninsured losses. And it just made me think about, like Gus had mentioned, I did listen to like the Hurricane Katrina Cal's podcast, and I did also listen to Katrina After the Flood. And it also made me think about how even if you did have hurricane insurance, just depending on, of course, the neighborhood that you lived in, so on and so forth, you could be paying and still not really get anything. And it reminded me of the Black actor who's, I forgot his name. I think he was like in The Wire, one of those type of TV shows. And Wendell Pierce, yes, sir. And I was watching this, one of the Spike Lee documentaries on Hurricane Katrina. And he was talking about how his father paid for years in his flood insurance. And he wouldn't even get enough to rebuild. I think maybe he even said he wouldn't even get enough to rebuild the shed, much less the house. So just wanted to mention that. Thank you.
Yeah, I think the report that they did from, I think that was NPR, they said that the rates of flood insurance in Houston are even lower. Like, I think it's lower than 25% in Houston. So, yeah, if folks recall, I think the major insurance companies, they had banner years. They made lots of money during the Hurricane Katrina 2005, 2006. They made lots of money, which means that they did not pay out on a lot of policies. I would expect something, and particularly if you got a whole lot of people who don't even have insurance to begin with, like, oh man, that's, you can just expect that. I would expect a sizable decline in Black Houston residents if things are as bad as have been reported. Other folks have commentary they wanted to get in? Folks satisfied? Anything else they needed to get in? Seen, if folks can recall, the top priority last week, the big prize fight, how quickly we can be reminded in the system of white supremacy about what is really things we should be serious about. Other folks, anything else they needed to get in last few minutes of the program?
I'm sorry. Another thing I wanted to add, I'm sorry, I forgot to add this. I was listening to one of the shows with Dr. Tommy Curry, and he said something that made me think about one of the segments where the Black reporter was protecting the suspected white supremacist. And he said, you can't talk about love when your oppressor has no moral consciousness. And just like you said, I haven't read Urugu, but it definitely makes you think about, we keep trying to, as Black people, we keep trying to appeal to, oh, well, they are human and they should see me as human. That's why these white people, they should be, you know, if they need help, then we should give them help. But I'm also, you know, trying to operate where if I don't have to help this white person, then I'm not going to. And I've actually been laughed at by my non-white Black family members because they don't understand my full mindset. Like, these people won't necessarily help us when we need the help. Even if they give you, you know, something small, this is something that they don't need or they don't want. We should not be so grateful because it's basically they're just, people are giving us their trash. And it took me a while to understand that I've been given things by white people. And then I had to sit back and I had to actually think about it, that they didn't want this thing anyway. They were going to throw it away anyway. So I definitely appreciate, you know, the segment and also everyone's comments on that.
Absolutely. I think Mr. Fuller made a comment about that a while back, saying racists, they will pile things up. They make it seem like it's all about acquiring things, these, you know, nice shiny objects and big houses and cars and jewelry and all that. But if you watch, you know, pile up all this stuff and then they'll have, you know, a garage sale and give it all away or give it to the Goodwill and go replace it, get new stuff. Like, they just go through that. That's not really, you know, that big a deal. When you've stolen everything, including the people on the planet, it's easy to give away this, that. Very, very easy in the system of white supremacy. And that many of us, myself included, have been, I think, confused by a racist's seeming act of generosity. Very easy to be generous when you've stolen everything. Any other comments folks needed to make sure they get in?
Yes, I would just want to remind us that in other parts of the world, there are non-white people who are suffering far greater than what's happening in this area of the world due to quote-unquote natural disasters. Because directly and sometimes indirectly, the global system of racism, white supremacy leaves their environment very much unstable. And they don't have any grocery stores to line up and go to, like in this part of the world.
Very important. I had a victim pointed that out earlier this week. I think 12,000, not 12,000, I think it was 1,200 people died in Southeast Asia. I think they had flooding and similar really bad storm, but just a lot more fatalities in terms of loss of human life. And that did not, in a lot of reports, did not get as much coverage, even though I can certainly understand us being closer to Houston, why that would be the dominant thing. But that did happen this week as well. And the animal rescue that happened in Katrina, they have whole books about the animal rescue effort during Hurricane Katrina, with Coast Guard members going out to rescue dogs and cats, and maybe they got some squirrels then too. But I saw that this time around as well. They had a report, in fact, where a person, I suspect he's white, but he said he drove 2 hours out of the way. He was in Texas. He was reporting or doing whatever he was doing. Saw this, I think he said the dog ran in his car. He put up pictures. People located the owner, and he drove 2 hours while the storm was still going and the flooding and everything, drove 2 hours to go return the dog to the owner. I find that sort of thing appalling. I guess they call that a human interest story, and what an act of kindness, and we all love dogs. I don't have that opinion, and the mutt that I've been dog sitting is about 5 feet away from me. That is not my opinion. He needs to go back to his owner. That is appalling with consistently Black people get turned away at gunpoint seeking help, but we will brave hell and high water to save a canine. You've got to be, well, I guess it's not a joke. That's the system of white supremacy. Niggers and Squirrels, people remember that broadcast, 2012. We had the author of the book Niggers and Squirrels on the program, where his grandparents, I think he said his grandparents grew up in Mississippi, and they had seen where police punished people more severely for killing squirrels out of season than for killing a Black person. Niggers and Squirrels, 2012. Other folks, any other commentary? Are folks satisfied?
Hey, Gus?
Yes, sir.
Have you heard of the story of the white male that was electrocuted in the storm, in Hurricane Harvey, rescuing his sister's cat? And as they found him, he said, "I'm dying." He basically said, "I'm dying, but I was trying to save this cat." And they're making like a big to-do about him sacrificing himself for a cat. His sister came out, I think, and his mother saying, "Oh, he's such a wonderful person, and he's fearless," and all this nonsense. And then all of this hoopla is being made over this white guy who basically, like an idiot, went in the water and got himself electrocuted by a power line to go try and save his sister's cat out. Did you hear that? Because the first thing I said when I posted it on BTR Community, I said, white people really love animals more than they love other human beings that they terrorize. And that was basically the my quote when I posted it. But I was just wondering if you saw that, because that seemed to have been making quite a bit of traction on the news as well.
I didn't. Another one, appalling. Snowball would have, you know, bitten the dust, as they say, forgive the metaphor. But I mean, yeah, come on. And again, if you can think, and this has happened repeatedly, it wasn't just Hurricane Katrina where they had Black people turned away at gunpoint from just crossing a bridge. You didn't have to give them a donut or a piece of pie, a glass of water. Just let them walk across the bridge. No. If folks remember Superstorm Sandy, where it was a Black female, she was out, she had her children with her, and a white male. He could have just, "Hey, can I get a dry spot just to stand for a moment?" And he refused. And she couldn't hold on to her children. They drowned. She survived. Folks remember that from the Superstorm Sandy. I think that was 2013. This is repeatedly. You just see this time after time. Black people denied help in these instances. But, oh, man, the dogs, the cats, the squirrels now. I think they had a zoo rescue effort over this past week as well.
Yes, I remember that, and I wanted to chime in about Irma, because they're saying that now Hurricane Irma is coming, and they're not sure of the trajectory of it, whether it's going to go into the Gulf, which will cause more problems for South Texas, or if it's going to go to hit Florida or go up the eastern seaboard. So they said it's too early to tell, but Hurricane Irma, they're saying, is going to be up to like a Category 4 hurricane from one of the articles I posted. And then recently, too, they just have put out information regarding a new strain of pneumonia that is drug resistant, deadly, and contagious. So ultimately, it's a new form that they don't have antibiotics that work for. So again, things like colloidal silver, four thieves essential oil, oil of oregano, lavender oil, all of those oils that provide antiseptic, disinfectant properties, and of course colloidal silver as well, are things that you're gonna want to stack up on and utilize to maintain your health in case you come in contact with somebody with one of these deadly virus or disease. You'll be able to fight it naturally or prevent yourself from getting sick. And also, you can, just to let people know, you can actually, if you have a cold water diffuser, you can actually take liquid colloidal silver and put it in the water so that those particles get in the air, and as well as the essential oil that disinfect, and you will literally purify the air. So even if someone else is sick in your house or in your environment, you won't get whatever they have. So I just wanted to put that out there too, just to give some more insight for folks who either can look to get those things, or if they have them, provide those other uses for it. Thank you. I'll mute my line.
Indeed. Self-care is important. The caller, last four digits, say 5429. Did you have commentary?
Glad to be here.
Yes, sir.
I just wanted to say just thank you for the program and the listeners. I've learned a lot since I've been listening for about 6 months now. I don't have any comment on the subject, but I'm learning.
Right on. The person that dialed in with a headset, did you have a commentary? Person that dialed in with a headset.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, I wanted to make a comment on your clip about the cop that said, we only kill black people. And it's kind of like, it's not kind of, it is what it is. Like Neely Fuller would say, he said what he said, and we should, and it's not about our feelings, whether he gets fired or he retires. It's a confession of, you know, I don't know if he had, you know, murders from a partner or if he's ever killed a black man in the line of duty, but that's a confession. If he's ever even worked with somebody, because he says we, not I, which is, I mean, that's RICO. That's not gang. And he says we kill black people. That's genocide. Like, this is not about him. The whole police, I mean, across the world should be on trial. I mean, he's not saying him. And this is a confession. And, I mean, it's like Neely Fuller said. He said what he said. That's how I feel about it. And that's all I had to say.
Enjoying retirement. So we were informed with the update. Enjoying retirement. Any other commentary folks wanted to get in? Well, I guess to make sure the caller who had asked about HAARP, I think, was mentioned. When these sort of events happen, I guess the same thing, similar to my views on Hurricane Katrina and the people who take the position that whites, race soldiers, bombed the levee and or manipulated the environment to create the storm, Hurricane Katrina. That could be true. I haven't seen any evidence. Basically, I've just heard people take that position. They didn't present a whole lot of data to show that this happened. Storms do happen. This Hurricane Harvey happened almost to the day of Hurricane Katrina. So I don't think, or at least I've seen no evidence, haven't come across any information that would link anything that was done during the eclipse to this storm. I would say in terms of racism, white supremacy, there is plenty. Even let's say that both Katrina, this storm happened naturally. There's plenty of evidence of racist activity without indicting whites for directly creating the storm, before and after, before, during, and after the weather phenomena. There's plenty of evidence that they can be indicted for without also including them saying or some sort of indictment that they created the storm as well. I think I recall Dr. Welsing, she was asked a similar question about, you know, did whites manipulate the environment? I mean, it's possible that they had that sort of technology. But I've also seen where sometimes that line of thinking does not go anywhere other than whites did this. And I just haven't seen where it, you know, there's a whole lot more you can do with that. It can kind of just leave you in a position of, you know, they're all powerful and there's nothing that can be do. They can make these monster storms to kill us all and that sort of thing. I mean, as I said, maybe they have that technology. Maybe that was brought into play. Maybe not. I haven't seen any evidence of that. I'm going that this was not an act of racism, white supremacy, that this happened as hurricanes do, and that racists have done a lot to manipulate and make this really, really bad, particularly for black people. Anybody else commentary they need to get in?
Yes, I want to speak about what you were just speaking about, whether or not they could control the weather or not. I think the one way to look at it is that despite the answer, these people are willing to capitalize on death and destruction. And that is one primary way that they have always enriched themselves, whether it was slaughtering each other in Europe or in how this country was started. So whenever there is suffering, expect white supremacist race holders to be profiting somewhere.
Perhaps I always feel
can I
like
be heard?
I hear Naomi Klein's voice when I hear that mentioned shock doctrine. Suspected racist Naomi Klein. Yes, Roz, we can hear you.
Yes, I wanted to say for anyone who's interested, including yourself, about finding out the facts that they do control and manipulate the weather scientifically, there's a great book called Warfare. I think we should maybe read it on the cows by Jerry E. Smith that details HAARP and the science behind it and the different countries that have it and how it's been used. And another one is HAARP, the ultimate weapon of the conspiracy. Those both get into the science behind it, when it was developed, countries that have access to it, and different ways it have been utilized. So I think that's something that's important. And also, I don't know if other people have heard about this, and we might want to get the black female we had on from Oklahoma that was dealing with the Daniel Holzkopf situation, because last Thursday it was exposed that he had a secret appeal hearing in regards to, I guess, trying to reduce or get thrown out the 263-year sentence that he was given due to the rape of the 12 women that they acknowledged, but it was probably like dozens more than that. But ultimately, that he's appealing this, and that they had a secret court hearing in regards to this appeal, and they only released that information last week, Thursday. They didn't divulge, you know, where it's at, but basically they're facilitating the appeal process now to try and, I guess, either get his sentence reduced or thrown out. So I just wanted to put that information out there. Hopefully, if there's people in the Oklahoma area that will be able to protest that or follow along with the court hearing to maybe get involved in trying to facilitate that appeal not being facilitated and completed, so that he can do the time that's necessary and rot and die in prison like he's supposed to. So I just wanted to throw that out there too. Thank you. I'll mute my line.
We'll make sure to follow up on that. I would encourage others to follow up on that case as well. I know we had a lot of people who were interested and supported when the month leading up to the trial, and then during the trial and conviction of serial rapist Daniel Holzkopf, former OKC enforcement official, race soldier. Any other comments? Folks satisfied?
I just wanted to add, just touching on what Raj said, the Daniel Holzkopf secret appeal. You can go to news9.com, and the article is named New Documents Unsealed Related to Daniel Holzkopf Appeal. And it was posted August 24th, 2017. And that's again on news9.com.
Spectacular. That's a local Oklahoma news affiliate, so always great to be able to get local direct information for these type of cases you want to follow. Anything else? Folks satisfied? Anything else they need to get in? Holiday weekend. I hope folks are being safe if you're going to participate in any activities, if it's going out, going to the beach, or any, I guess, end of summer hurrahs. Stay codified. I would encourage sobriety would be grand. I think since this is a holiday, they'll probably have increased enforcement officials out on the highways and roads and what have you, probably some sobriety checkpoints. So just keep that in mind if you all are going to do anything for the quote-unquote holiday, at least listeners in the U.S. Anything else? Any last comments? I will assume folks are satisfied. If we have younger listeners, if you are starting the school year, stay safe. I would be alert and mindful of potential racist classmates and educators, staff at your academic facility. Hopefully you have parents who are speaking to you about what racism, white supremacy is, and what they want you to do if something should happen at school. But definitely be mindful, be leery of the little white children. Boys and girls, they are racist. The bigger ones, they're racist too. That said, we should be back in the week. The health issues have just totally wrecked scheduling, so just having to take it on a day-to-day basis, but we will evaluate and hopefully Have great healing, and at minimum, we'll be here Thursday for the Workplace Racism. France Fanon, study session number 6, picking up where we left off at in Wretched of the Earth for this coming week. But you can always check the Facebook page, Black Talk Radio Network, for updates. Thanks for the concern, people who were writing on our Facebook page and elsewhere about my wisdom teeth being extracted. Much obliged. Again, hopefully things will move along quickly. And again, thoughts and prayers to all the folks in the Texas area who have been dealing with just cataclysmic disaster over the past week or so. Hope folks are safe. And just, again, dealing with things. I don't even know how you begin to deal with and manage from all of that. But, man, number one priority, I hope you are someplace safe and can begin to deal with the steps in trying to figure out what is next to do in trying to restore and rebuild from all of that. But definite thoughts and prayers to all the folks, Cal's listeners, supporters down in the Houston, Texas area. Man, more to come there for sure. With that, thanks for everyone listening in. I hope it has been worthy of your time and energy. Hope you all are taking great care of yourselves and using your time in the most constructive manner possible. We will be back soon. Thanks so much for sharing a bit of your time and insight for the evening. I will say it again. Please buckle up. Anything that we can do to minimize contact with race soldiers, badge or no, great step towards solving this problem. Anytime you're in a vehicle, certainly we are not under the influence. We should get a reputation, we being black people in particular, for driving sober, being buckled up, and just being sober, period. Even if I'm not behind the wheel, in terms of just how we function in an environment dominated by white terrorism, but for sure, sobriety would be best, particularly if you're going to be operating a motor vehicle. Things can go bad quickly. We want to be able to make phenomenal decisions at all times to keep ourselves safe. I definitely think being sober would help out there. That said, Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cal signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
Hey, I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my condition.
Mm-hmm.
Even my conditioning has been conditioned.